You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Flashpoints.
This is Guns and Butter.
There's something happening, yeah. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
Now, suppose a country owes money to another country. How can you collect unless there's an international court and an enforcement system? The IMF and the World Bank were part of that enforcement system, and now they're saying, no, we're not going to be part of that anymore. We're only working for the U.S. State Department and Pentagon. And the Pentagon tells the IMF it's okay, they don't have to pay Russia or China, then they don't have to pay. So all of a sudden, that's broken up what seemed to be a global order that was created after World War II. That's all been changed now. The world is being split into two halves, the U.S. orbit and countries that the U.S. cannot control and whose officials are not on the U.S. payroll, so to speak.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter, Dr. Michael Hudson. Today's show, the new global financial Cold War. Dr. Hudson is a financial economist and historian. He is president of the Institute for the Study of Long-Term Economic Trend, a Wall Street financial analyst, and distinguished research professor of economics at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. His 1972 book, Super Imperialism, The Economic Strategy of American Empire, is a critique of how the United States exploited foreign economies through the IMF and World Bank. His latest book is Killing the Host, How Financial Parasites and Debt Destroy the Global Economy. Today we discuss his article, The IMF Changes Its Rules to Isolate China and Russia. Michael Hudson, welcome. It's been far too long since we've last spoken.
Well, it's good to be back. Last time we were together was in Italy.
That's right, Rimini, Italy. What year was that?
It must have been 4 years ago because we were there with Stephanie Kelton from UMKC, who's now Bernie Sanders appointed her head of the Senate Finance Committee for the Democratic Party, and Bill Black of UMKC was also there. And I used some of my lectures there in the book Finance, Capitalism, and Its Discontents, and that was published a few years ago. So lost in the mists of time.
Well, Michael, I produced actually 7 shows from the presentations in Rimini on modern money theory with you, with Marshall Auerbach, William K. Black, Stephanie Kelton, and they were blockbuster shows, I must say.
That's great. That's great. That was a wonderful presentation. And when we walked in, it was in this big soccer auditorium, and we felt like we were the Beatles walking down the middle. People were cheering us and calling out our names, and it was as if we were basketball players.
Well, the Italians turned out to be so warm and so enthusiastic for an alternative economic theory. I was amazed,
yep.
Too.
And people came there from Spain and from all over. So that was one of the best presentations any of us had ever been at.
Yeah, I'm so, so happy I was able to be there. That is a conference to remember for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I've been reading your article, The IMF Changes Its Rules to Isolate China and Russia. It rings an alarming bell about the implications of rule changes at the International Monetary Fund, the IMF, which makes loans to governments. Before we discuss these IMF rule changes specifically, what precipitated these drastic policy shifts at the IMF?
Well, the policy shifts are a number. The first policy shift was that in the past, the IMF has not made loans to countries that are in default to governments. That's because in the past, the government in question was the U.S. government. And since World War II, almost all of the international financial bailout loans, stabilization loans, or currency loans by the IMF and World Bank has involved the U.S. government in conjunction with a lot of U.S. banks. Well, for the first time, now that China and its associated group, the BRICS, are growing, countries are borrowing not only from the United States and subject to U.S. Lobbying forces, but they can now borrow from China and other countries. So the United States has basically changed the IMF rules and said, wait a minute, it's okay for the IMF to make loans the countries that don't pay China and Russia or the BRICS, because we're in a new Cold War. The IMF really is working for us. And as long as the U.S. has the veto power in the IMF, its delegate there can veto any loan to a country that owes money to the United States that the United States doesn't wish to support. But it has no objection at all for the U.S. making loans to U.S. satellites, such as Ukraine, that owe money to Russia. So the aim of the change was that Ukraine last December owed $3 billion to Russia on a loan that was coming due from the Russian State Investment Fund. And the United States is doing everything it can to hurt Russia economically, thinking that if it hurts it enough, somehow Russia will capitulate to the U.S. strategy. And the new Cold War strategy is basically an attempt to force other countries to privatize their economy, to follow neoliberal policies, and essentially to open their economies to U.S. Corporations and U.S. Banks. And the IMF rules change was to mobilize the IMF basically as an agent of the U.S. Defense Department with a small side office in Wall Street. And all of a sudden, it's become very clear that the IMF is not an international institution for global economic performance. It's an arm of U.S. Cold War diplomacy that's moving very far to the right very quickly under the Obama administration.
We now have the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, the SCO, as an alternative military alliance to NATO, and the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, the AIIB, which threatens to replace the IMF and World Bank. How successful do you think these new alternatives to the Western banking system will be?
Well, the big point is that the Western banking system, the World Bank and the IMF, are completely unsuccessful. The IMF has followed a kind of junk economics that says if you owe money to a foreign bondholders or banks, the solution is you have to impose austerity on the country. Austerity will enable you to squeeze enough tax money out of your domestic economy to pay foreigners. This is the same theory that the British and the Americans and the French used in the 1920s to insist that Germany could pay any amount of reparations if it only would tax the economy enough. This theory was completely shown to be false by John Maynard Keynes and also by the American Harold Moulton at the Brookings Institution. And all of the lessons of the 1920s were sort of rejected by the IMF because they know very well, and the staff has made it very clear, that austerity doesn't enable country to pay the debts. Austerity makes countries even less able to pay the debts. And that means that they need to borrow even more, and then the IMF comes in with the number two punch. The number one punch is austerity. The number two punch is say, well, I guess our program didn't work. What a surprise. You now have to begin privatizing your industry and your natural resources, sell off your land, and they tell other countries essentially what they told Greece over the last year. Greece is sort of the test case. When the austerity plan of the IMF loans from 2010 and thereafter didn't help Greece, they're forcing Greece to sell off its islands, sell off its ports, sell off its water systems, sell off everything it has. The IMF had to wait until it made that demand, and once the demand had already made on Greece in the summer, then it came to Ukraine. So the number one punch against the Ukraine by the IMF was to impose austerity on the pretense, of course it's junk economics, but the pretense that Ukraine could then pay the foreign banks. But when this made things worse, then you have the World Bank and the USAID come in, and the U.S. appointed a finance minister there whose job was to point out, here's the agricultural land, the gas rights, the other public enterprises and natural resources that that Ukraine can sell off to American investors. Well, the idea is that if American investors can buy all of the key infrastructure and the commanding heights of the Ukrainian economy, that it can pry Ukraine apart from Russia. And Ukraine was basically a key of the Russian economy, to the point where much of the Russian military and space exploration industrial output was produced actually in the Donbas region in eastern Ukraine. And so the idea was that by separating Ukraine from Russia, this can be the first step in trying to carve up Russia, carve up China, and break them into little pieces, essentially to try to turn China and Russia into the Mideast and to treat them like we've treated Libya and Iraq and Afghanistan and Syria, smash them up, a smash and grab exercise, and take their natural resources and whatever.
What is the aim of the Trans-Pacific Partnership Treaty, and how is it at odds with the Asian Infrastructure Bank, the AIIB?
Well, I could give a glib answer and say the aim is to reduce the population by 50%, to starve people, to abolish pensions, and to spread poverty. That actually is the effect. The cover story is not really trade at all. The cover story is to force privatization, to reverse what was central to the whole progressive era. For the last 300 years, the assumption of Europe and North America was that you were going to have a mixed economy with the government investing in infrastructure, in roads, in transportation, communications, water and sewer, energy, and that the job of the government infrastructure was to provide these basic needs at minimum cost in order to make a low-cost competitive economy. That's how America got rich. That's how Germany industrialized. It's how Europe did. The aim of the Trans-Pacific Partnership is essentially to dissolve governments and to say the entire economy should be owned and operated by private owners, private enterprise, for short-term profits. There are a number of aims. One is to nullify any domestic environmental protection that costs money, to nullify any domestic protection of labor, to nullify any domestic attempt to tax natural resources or to tax economic rent. And the idea is to turn the roads and the transport system into toll roads that will be owned by foreigners and run at a high charge, to turn the internet, to turn the water system into toll systems, to charge for water, to charge for basic needs, and all of a sudden to impose really what is very much a neo-feudalism rentier economy throughout the world of taking over the government sector essentially by the finance, industrial, and real estate sector, the FIRE sector. So you could say the idea is to roll back the Enlightenment and restore feudalism. That sounds like an extreme statement, but people don't realize how radical the investment agreements are on here. Any country that will try to, for instance, when Australia fined Philip Morris by raising the charges on cigarettes, Philip Morris sued Australia. So Australia, the government, has to pay Philip Morris the amount of money that Philip Morris would have made if people would have continued to smoke and get cancer at the existing rate. when Ecuador tried to sue oil companies for pollution, the oil company sued, and the country has to pay the oil company the amount of profit it would make if it continued to produce oil by polluting the land to an infinite degree. No government anywhere in the world that signs this will be free to regulate the environment, to tax private enterprise, and essentially the new buyers of the roads, the water systems, the sewer systems can use these as rent extraction opportunities. That means they can somehow charge whatever the market will bear and treat foreign countries sort of like New York City cable customers are treated. We have one supplier. I live in Forest Hills in Queens. We have one supplier, Time Warner Cable. If I want cable, I have to pay what they charge, and it has nothing to do at all with the cost of production. That's what economic rent is. It's a revenue above the cost of production, and for hundreds of years, the economics of Adam Smith, Ricardo, John Stuart Mill, Thorstein Veblen were all about how to create an economy that would produce everything it would cost without any free lunch, without any kind of unearned income. Well, the aim of the Trans-Pacific Partnership and the European version is to realize that, wait a minute, the economy is all about unearned income. We want to be able to get economic rent. So essentially, the rentiers' interests have backed the kind of junk economics that has fought back against classical economics, against the progressive era, and against social democracy to create a very right-wing government that they call free trade in a kind of Orwellian doublethink.
I'm speaking with financial economist and historian Dr. Michael Hudson. Today's show, The New Global Financial Cold War. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter.
Now, have these rulings by the World Trade Organization against these countries you mentioned, Australia was one, have these been enforced?
I don't know the details. I think, for one thing, the first process of enforcement is to spend up to $100 million in legal fees. It's almost impossible for a poor government, like, say, Ecuador, or even Australia, to spend the legal fees that it costs to defend. Secondly, the decisions are made outside of government. They're made by the decisions as to how much governments have to pay corporations that are regulated as compensation damages are made by a small group of referees that are sort of a revolving door between acting as referees and working as lobbyists for these corporations. So I believe they were enforced in Australia. I don't know any of the specific day-to-day details.
China accelerated its creation of the alternative China International Payments System, CIPS, and its own credit card system. What is the SWIFT interbank clearing system, and is the new Chinese payment system a threat to it?
Well, the SWIFT system, when you write checks on a checking account, all the banks have a clearing system. And if you can imagine, it's a huge computer software program that enables you to take a check from one bank and write it to somebody else, and the money's cleared into another bank. It's a checks clearing system. Now, about a year ago, the United States said, well, now that we're going to war with Russia, and it may very quickly be a military war, we can hurt the Russian economy, but we don't have to send troops in. We don't have to invade. That's past war. No country is going to invade another country with troops again. But they said we can hold the Russian or any other economy hostage by all of a sudden excluding it from the SWIFT payments clearing system, so that all of a sudden, if their banks and individuals and corporations can't clear any money, and if they're paralyzed, then we've smashed their economy. Well, as soon as the Americans threatened to do this, China and Russia said, wait a minute, we don't want any other country, especially one that says they want to go to war with us. And Obama and Hillary Clinton have already made threats of military war against Russia. they say, look, we'd like to be part of a global unit, but as long as the United States is running it for its own interest and is acting in a hostile way, we've got to protect our own bank clearing system. So China took the lead in creating its own bank clearing system so that people and companies and government organizations in China and the other BRICS countries won't have to be hostage to the United States saying, aha, we can do with a computer program what we did to the Iranian centrifuges. Just like we blew up the Iranian centrifuges by coming into their computer program and screwing them up, we can do that with SWIFT. Well, China and the BRICS have moved to defend themselves against this.
Well, now, has this China international payment system, has this been implemented yet, or is it still being planned?
I think they're still in the process of developing it because it's awfully hard to develop a system like this. That's why there's an inertia for these things. And the inertia is you build on the existing clearing systems, and it takes a lot of time to develop something like Microsoft. That's why when Mac computers, which people like to buy, were developed, they're still using a Windows program. And I have a Mac computer that uses Windows because it's so complex and takes so many billions of dollars to write a program that doesn't have glitches in it. And I think the Chinese are still trying to work out the glitches because they don't expect overt warfare quite yet.
Russian Prime Minister Putin proposed a partnership, or at least cooperation, between the West and the emerging military and economic partnerships in the East. Putin's overture to the West seems to have fallen on deaf ears. Why do you think?
Well, this is the same idea that has been made since the 1990s, even before Putin came in to power. The idea was that, well, Russia's willing to join NATO. The point was that Russia was under the belief that atomic war between the industrial nations of the world is now out of the question. They do face a common threat, and that is Wahhabi Islam funded by Saudi Arabia, the Wahhabi terrorism. Russia is concerned about the Saudi-backed terrorists on its southern front from Georgia, Azerbaijan, all the way through Central Asia. And the Chinese also are concerned about Wahhabi terrorism through the Uyghurs. And the United States, wait a minute, Wahhabis, the American Foreign Legion. ISIS is the American Foreign Legion. When Hillary Clinton overthrew the Libyan government, the arms were turned over to ISIS. The military stockpiles were turned over to ISIS. The central bank resources were robbed and turned over to ISIS. When America marched into Iraq, it turned over essentially the entire the Sunni army and the armed forces and all those billions of dollars of shrink-wrapped $100 bills over to ISIS. So basically, although America nominally pretends to oppose ISIS when certainly it has to when they kill Americans, basically ISIS is America's way of breaking up countries that decide that may threaten not to be part of the international dollar standard. And Russia had hoped that somehow the United States would see that this is a crazy system, that America and Russia and Europe can all get rich in mutual trade, and that if the textbook theories were right, if Europe, for instance, were to pursue its economic interest, it would see that it was a natural trading partner of Russia, that Europeans and probably Americans would go to Russia and try to build up the economy because they certainly need entrepreneurs there. They certainly need a build-up. And instead of pursuing a mutual prosperity sphere between Europe, Russia, and the United States. The United States has pressed Europe into a dead zone of neoliberal austerity that is just shrinking the economy and carving it off to prevent any kind of prosperity for Europe, if this prosperity would also result in welfare for Russia or China. So the idea from the American side is, well, we'll treat Russia like we treated Cuba and like we treated Iran and Libya and isolate them, and they'll knuckle under. But instead, obviously, Russia's much bigger than Cuba or North Korea, and China's much bigger. And instead of just surrendering to the American neoliberal economic plan, they've decided America's driven them together just out of purely defensive alignment, and America's brought about precisely the Eurasian unity that it set out to try to prevent.
Yes, I believe in your paper at one point you described some of the IMF members as wearing suicide vests. I thought that was a pretty good description.
Well, yeah, it's like the United States walked into the IMF meeting with a suicide vest and said, we want the IMF to only serve U.S. interests, not international interests. So the IMF, as an ostensibly honest broker to help countries stabilize, that's broken now. And if you look, there are a whole series of rules that have been radically changed. For instance, I mentioned before not to lend to a country that owes money to a government. That wasn't really in the IMF Articles of Agreement. But what was in the IMF Articles was you're not supposed to lend to a country that has no visible means of paying back the loan. That was called the No More Argentinas rule that was passed in 2001 after the IMF lent Argentina money to pay its bondholders, but Argentina had no way at all of repaying the IMF loan. And so the IMF broke this rule when it lent to Greece after 2010. And a lot of the staff left the IMF. They protested. The IMF board said, wait a minute, how can you lend this money to Greece to pay German banks and French banks and English banks, and all of a sudden you bail out the bondholders, you bail out the bankers, and there's no way Greece can pay? This is crazy. And the IMF at that point overruled it by saying, well, we're going to pass a new rule, and that is systemic risk loans, that the IMF can violate its Articles of Agreement and lend to any country if failure to repay loan would be a systemic risk. And the definition of systemic risk is a bondholder losing more than $1. That if any bondholder anywhere in the world loses more than a dollar, that would be a disaster to the system, that essentially you could say only the 99% have to lose. In order to prevent the 1% of the economy, in order to prevent bondholders and banks from losing, the IMF will back the entire wrecking of an economy, the smashing of an economy, the covering up of the government, the overriding of democracy in order to support the bankers. That rule, by the way, just a few days ago, on January 29th, the IMF finally negated that rule, saying that, okay, we're not going to use that excuse anymore. But another element of the IMF Articles of Agreement was it's not supposed to lend to a borrower at war. And for one obvious reason, if a country's at war, especially if it's in a civil war, bombing its export sector, then how on earth can Ukraine ever obtain the money to pay a foreign debt if most of its exports were to Russia, and the attack on the Donbass and the eastern Ukraine has destroyed the export industry? So the United States said, no, we're going to make the loan to Ukraine, and the managing director said, I hope Ukraine doesn't spend it to go to war. Well, the very next day, Poroshenko came out and said, thank God we have the loan. Now we're going to give $1.5 billion to one of our kleptocrats. We're going to give it to our big bankers. And they immediately moved it offshore. And he said, now we can afford to go to war. So you have the IMF quite obviously violating it. And then the fourth rule is the IMF isn't supposed to lend to a country that has little likelihood of carrying out the austerity program. They're called conditionalities, which involve crushing democratic opposition in a totalitarian manner. Well, Ukraine is cutting back pensions. It's imposing austerity, but there's very little chance of the country surviving as a democracy. So the United States basically came in and said, well, we're no longer backing democracies. We're dropping the pretense. We know that in the 1960s and 70s, we backed dictatorships in Latin America. We backed the overthrow of Allende in Chile. No more democracy in Ukraine. We do lend to dictatorships. The IMF will lend to countries at war. It will lend to the countries that cannot pay, as long as the countries do what we want and pay our banks, but don't pay Russian banks and don't pay the BRICS banks.
I'm speaking with financial economist and historian Dr. Michael Hudson. Today's show, the new global financial Cold War. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter.
Now, Michael, you've already begun to answer this question, but maybe we can get a little clarification on it. Russia's National Wealth Fund made a loan to the Ukraine. You've brought this up. This Russian loan was protected by IMF lending practice, and the bonds were registered under London's creditor-oriented rules and courts. Describe how the original structure of post-World War II sovereign lending practices were protected by IMF and World Bank rules.
The IMF said it would not make a loan to a country that owed money or was in default of a loan to any government. That did not renegotiate in good faith its loan with the foreign government. Well, Ukraine owed money to the Russian sovereign wealth fund, so that obviously was a government organization. And the Russian loan was made on concessionary terms, but it also had protections. Because it was a sovereign wealth fund, it protected itself by registering the loan in England. And there's been quite a bit of debate in Russia. Can Ukraine avoid paying Russia and still not owe any money? And all during last year, the U.S. Treasury and U.S. bankers had a long discussion about, well, how can Ukraine default and still be able to qualify for loans from the IMF? Well, we answered that already. The IMF rules were changed, so it can make loans. And remember, the European Union and international banks usually will not join in a loan to a country or make loans to a country that the IMF doesn't also join in the loans and to a country not in good standing with the IMF. So all of a sudden, all of this was changed, and instead of protecting the system of loans among governments, the IMF said, we're only protecting loans to the dollar area. We're not protecting loans to governments that the United States doesn't like, which could be anybody that doesn't follow neoliberal policies. So basically, the United States sought to remove Russia's legal ability to collect the $3 billion that Ukraine owed. And there was a discussion, well, maybe Ukraine can call it an odious debt, because anything owed to Russia is odious, because Russia is an odious country. And so you had Obama come and say, Putin is a kleptocrat and is corrupt, without giving any indication of how he was corrupt. And as if for the first time in 50 years, here America's lent to every corrupt dictator in Latin America, in Africa, in Asia, and it's never called another head of state corrupt. The first person that's called corrupt is the Russian leader Putin, without any indication of, well, where are these offshore bank accounts he has? Can you give us some details? Without any details at all, such as every reporter's been able to get on the corrupt U.S. puppets from Pinochet down through Tony Blair and you know, other people. It's just amazing that the U.S. essentially is trying to say, well, we're splitting the whole legal system, the whole system of international law. We're going to have an excuse not to pay. And then the idea is that, well, at least if Ukraine realizes it will lose any attempt not to pay Russia through the British courts where the bonds are registered, which are very creditor-oriented, as you can imagine, because Britain was a creditor nation. But somehow at least they can tie it up, and they think that, well, with oil now below $30 a barrel and with Russia needing money, maybe we can just starve Russia into submitting to the U.S. Dictates. And this is a crazy idea because Russia obviously is not going to surrender. And you had a few days ago Foreign Minister Lavrov saying, well, I guess we've got to rethink our relationship with the West. It's obvious the West doesn't want unity, and we've got to rethink our relationship with Europe. If Europe really decides that it wants to be the 51st state of America and not push its own economic interests, push interests of the United States, then I guess we've got to turn eastward towards China and towards the BRICS. Too bad. It could have been a nice mutual prosperity relationship.
Well, you've obviously titled your article, "The IMF Changes Its Rules to Isolate China and Russia," because that's what they're doing. The whole purpose behind these rule changes is to isolate China and Russia. Now, well, China and Russia were cooperating with the IMF and the World Bank, weren't they?
Yes, they were. And the real objective of all this is China. For 3 years, the United States has been discussing very openly, how can we isolate China? We don't want it to be another power. It's okay if the Chinese labor works at very low prices to supply Walmart with low-priced exports, but we don't want China to be an independent country. How can we fight against China? Well, China's been able to give American investors and American importers enough of a common interest that they've been able to prevent the U.S. government from intensifying the Cold War against China. But Russia doesn't have all of that much leverage offering the West ways to get rich, especially since they threw Khodorkovsky in jail after he tried to sell all of the Russian oil mineral wealth to Exxon at a huge price that would have essentially taken Russian oil out of the national patrimony. So you have a situation where China wants to make its currency part of the global currency basket of the IMF. It wants to establish the yen on the same status as the dollar so that it can avoid having to rely on American banks for its export trade, for its domestic credit creation. I'll give you an example. Around 1992 and 1993, the American neoliberals who went to Russia convinced Russia that they actually needed to hold U.S. dollars as backing for their domestic ruble currency. And since they didn't have many U.S. dollars, being Russia, the result was a deflation that ended up deindustrializing most of Russia. Well, obviously, there was no need at all for Russia to borrow in a foreign currency to make domestic expenses on its own labor and its own industry. Well, same thing with China. They want to be free of any reliance on the dollar for anything except what they need to import from the United States or to defend the currency against raids by, say, George Soros, who said he expects the yen to go down. And that's sort of a sign to currency raiders to try to profiteer by driving the Chinese currency down. The Chinese are trying to free themselves from any interconnections to the dollar orbit except to get dollars that they need to import things from the United States, which I guess are not very much except for maybe movies.
Now, you mentioned four of its own rules that the IMF broke in making loans to Ukraine. Now, you mentioned these four rules, and I'm wondering if you wouldn't mind just very briefly stating what the four broken rules are so that people can kind of get their head around this.
One rule is not to lend to a country that has no visible means of paying back the loan. That's the No More Argentina rules. The second rule is not to lend to a country that repudiates its debt to official creditors, meaning a country that won't pay that it owes to another government. So that's how the IMF was an enforcer of the creditor cartel. The third rule is not to lend to a country at war. Ukraine's at war. It's at a civil war with the East. And the fourth rule is not to lend to a country that is not going to impose the IMF austerity conditionalities that are meant to smash it so poor that it ends up bankrupt and having to sell off and privatize its natural resources. So all these rules are being broken. The Ukraine has not begun to sell off its natural resources yet, and there's some argument going on because the kleptocrats want to hold on to them, and the kleptocrats want to make the same deal that the Russian kleptocrats made in the early 90s. They'll sell maybe 25% of their monopoly to the U.S. buyers, list on the U.S. stock exchange, let the U.S. stock exchange bid it up, and then they'll sell their 75% and take the payment in London or New York or wherever, and essentially take all the money out of Ukraine, leaving Ukraine with no money at all in the bank, but with owing an enormous amount of money every year for the transmission of profits on agricultural land and economic rents extracted from the roads and gas and other infrastructure that's sold off.
You say that an issue that is between the East and the West is a philosophy of development. How does development differ in the two systems?
The neoliberal American philosophy of development is a Orwellian term for the absence of development, to reverse development. The neoliberal plan is you're going to develop into a post-industrial society, and by post-industrial they mean rolling back the history to feudalism. Instead of the government taking the lead and providing basic services at a low price to enable you to become a competitive economy, you're going to take the roads and basic energy system, electricity, sewer, water, and you're going to sell it, and the new buyers are going to charge whatever the market will bear. Well, this is going to impoverish the country. It's going to be exactly the opposite of what development economics was taught when I went to school 50 years ago, and what was taught and expected from the 19th century through most of the 20th century.
What kind of scenario have the U.S. State Department and Treasury officials been discussing for more than a year as a way of fighting back against Chinese and Russian infrastructure loans to other countries? I think you started to, you've talked a little bit about this already.
Only by not making loans themselves. The United States did not join the AIIB and indeed tried to discourage other countries from joining. There was a lot of hand-wringing when England joined the AIIB, and other countries were trying to do it. The United States essentially is trying to create an iron curtain separating the BRICS from the U.S. Dollar orbit. It's a financial curtain. It's not an iron curtain. It's an electronic curtain.
Well, then, I think, didn't you write in your article that the IMF would go ahead and loan to countries and tell them that they wouldn't have to repay their loans to China or Russia, that they could take money from the IMF?
Well, there's no vehicle. In order to they didn't tell countries you don't have to repay. The problem is there has to be an international court. There has to be an enforcement vehicle. For instance, you have a lot of the vulture funds claiming that Argentina owes them money on the vulture funds purchase of Argentine bonds. But they haven't been able to collect. They were able to get, I think, Nigeria, an African country, to grab one of the Argentine training boats. But then because it was government property, the country was directed to release it. Suppose a country owes money to another country. How can you collect unless there's an international court and an enforcement system? The IMF and the World Bank were part of that enforcement system, and now they're saying, no, we're not going to be part of that anymore. We're only working for the U.S. State Department and Pentagon. And the Pentagon tells the IMF it's okay, they don't have to pay Russia or China, then they don't have to pay. So all of a sudden, that's broken up what what seemed to be a global order that was created after World War II. That's all been changed now. The world is being split into two halves, the U.S. orbit and countries that the U.S. cannot control and whose officials are not on the U.S. payroll, so to speak.
I'm speaking with financial economist and historian Dr. Michael Hudson. Today's show, The New Global Financial Cold War. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter.
You described this as a tectonic geopolitical shift that will be fought with all the power of an American century inquisition. What do you mean by inquisition?
Well, meaning dirty tricks. Obama has said we're not going to invade another country because no country is really able to mobilize things. He said we can go targeted assassination. So the U.S. is doing essentially what Germany did in the 30s. You work within other governments to try to bribe, to get them to promote people who in foreign countries who work for the United States. You want to make sure that in England, for instance, that someone like Tony Blair becomes prime minister, who will do whatever he's told by the U.S. You want to make sure that if a country tries to be independent like Chile did, you come in and you kill the president. And if you have countries that want land reform and an alternative to America, you did what America did. You start Operation Condor and you you kill 10,000 professors, land reformers, and union leaders. Essentially, it's a terrorist group. And by inquisition, you use the American Foreign Legion, ISIS, which you send ISIS into whatever country you want to smash and grab.
You write that, quote, we have American Pentagon capitalism with financial bubbles deteriorating into a polarized rentier economy and a resurgence of old-fashioned imperialism. If and when a break comes, it will not be marginal, but a seismic geopolitical shift, unquote. What are your thoughts on the coming breakup of the post-World War II dollarized global financial system? What do you think it will look like?
Well, essentially, other countries are going to try to get rich in the same way that the United States tried to get rich, and that is by promoting domestic prosperity, a domestic market, subsidize domestic research and development, just like the United States has subsidized high technology, and you try to prevent rent seeking. In other words, you try to prevent special privileges, whether they're patent privileges or they're ownership of cable TV systems. You try to prevent super profits, excess profits, or economic rent, unearned income. You want people to be able to earn in a way that reflects their contribution to production, and you want to uplift the quality of labor. You want to educate your labor force. You want to rise them into a modern technological labor force. All this takes government subsidy. And it takes a mixed economy of government and the private sector, where the government picks up most of the external economies, the infrastructure costs, in order to make the private sector able to compete more. So other countries are going to do just what the United States did since the Civil War. They'll be protectionist. They will try to upgrade the quality of their labor. They will upgrade the quality of their agriculture. They will promote high technology industry. They'll promote public health care and basic needs at a very low expense. They'll essentially achieve what social democracy and the progressive era set out to achieve a century ago, and which has now been rejected by the United States and Europe.
Yes, in your article, you've written that the result is to split the world into pro-U.S. economies going neoliberal and economies maintaining public investment in infrastructure and what used to be viewed as progressive capitalism.
I think when the Soviet Union fell apart, And Russia and other countries invited U.S. advisors over. They were under the impression that the advisors were going to help them develop in the same way that the United States had developed and become as prosperous a consumer economy and a productive industrial economy as the United States was. And what they didn't realize is that the United States had no intention at all of helping them get rich the way the United States did. The advisors came in to smash and grab. They meant to deindustrialize Russia, to deindustrialize Latvia, and to really pull all the connecting links out of the old Soviet Union and to turn Russia back into a raw materials supplier and really to turn the former Soviet states into third world economies. And the result was not only poverty, but mass immigration. You can look at Latvia, for instance, as an example that is applauded as the Baltic miracle, the success story. And the miracle is that wages have been going down steadily for the last decade, that about 10 to 20% of the population has left, mainly working-age population. Same thing in Russia. Much of Russia's technically trained population, engineers and others, came to the United States and helped United States industrialization as Russia was neoliberalized, but it didn't help Russian industrialization at all.
And what about the post-2010 IMF loan packages to Greece? Now, are they an instance of the IMF breaking its own rules or not?
Well, that was when the debate within the IMF occurred over the no more Argentina's rules. You don't make a loan to a country with no visible ability to repay. This is what my book, Killing the Host, is about. I have three chapters on Greece as an example of how the IMF has, in the past, the IMF would only smash up third world countries, mainly for U.S. Mineral companies and other exporters. But Greece was really the first European country that the IMF came in explicitly to smash up and break in order to privatize it. I have one chapter on Latvia also. So this gets into the topic that my Killing the Host is all about.
You write that Dominique Strauss-Kahn backed the hardline U.S. European Central Bank position regarding Greece. So did Christine Lagarde in 2015, overriding staff protests.
Within the IMF, the IMF staff had said, don't make the loan to Greece, it can't pay. But then Strauss-Kahn met with the French, and he's French, and he wanted to run for the French presidency. And the French president at the time said, look, you can't possibly be a politician in France if you're head of the IMF and you let Greece default on its bonds. There go the French banks. We're going to go under if the IMF doesn't bail us out. And then President Obama went to the Group of 20 meeting after Tim Geithner, the Treasury Secretary, had been on the phone with Europe and said, wait a minute, if Greece doesn't pay the French and German and bondholders, the American banks have made huge bets and the American banks will go under. And if the American banks will go under, then the European banks will go under. So even though it's true that you know that Greece can't pay, the whole system will go down, meaning that American banks will lose more than $1, and we can't let American gamblers, you know, they've all taken a bet on this horse race, they can't lose a penny on this. It's better that you break up Greece, even break up Europe. We're willing to smash Europe as long as we don't lose one penny, because one penny to America is equal to all the wealth you have in Europe and all of your population. That's the enormous asymmetry of the egotism of the U.S., the kind of naked greed that they're willing to smash the IMF, to smash Greece, to smash your integration, just so Goldman Sachs and the Wall Street, five Wall Street banks that had made a bet that Greece would pay, wouldn't lose on that horse race. So that led the head of the European section of the IMF to resign. She went to Canada, I think, and the Canadians published her whistleblowing on there. I mean, it just it destroyed the IMF already at that time, even before the Ukrainian crisis.
You've written that the reason for smashing Greece's economy was to deter Podemos in Spain and similar movements in Italy and Portugal from pursuing national prosperity instead of Eurozone austerity. Do you think that was an important component?
That was, at the time, that's certainly what the European Central Bank said was critical. They said, we cannot let Syriza win. And the finance minister of Greece, Yanis Varoufakis, said that he was told that while meeting with the IMF and the Europeans, that democracy doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what the people voted for, that Greece had to pay the debt that its previous corrupt governments had agreed to. And in the Financial Times and almost all the international press, you had a discussion, wait a minute, if they write down Greece's debt just because Greece will be wrecked otherwise, then they're going to have to write down the debt of Italy, they're going to have to write down the debt of Spain, and they're going to have to write down the debt of Portugal, and the whole debt collection system will go. Either we save the banks or we save the economy. And the IMF and the United States State Department said, save the banks, not the economy. And that's exactly what Obama did in the United States when he bailed out the banks in 2008 and did not write down the debts, did not break up the banks. That's why Bernie Sanders is running today. So essentially, the U.S. orbit says save the banks, not the economy. And the problem is that the interest-bearing debt grows exponentially. Any rate of interest is a doubling time. So the debt is going to grow and grow exponentially, and that means you're going to have to impose deeper and deeper austerity. And every economy that you impose this austerity on is going to react like Russia or Latvia or Greece. There's going to be emigration. There's going to be a decline in the birth rate. There's going to be a rise in the death rate. There's going to be spread of disease. There's going to be a shrinking market and essentially falling apart. And the struggle of our time is going to be whether you save the banks or the economy. In the end, the banks can't be saved because most debts are unpayable. And the United States said, well, they may be unpayable out of current earnings and out of current exports, but there's still room to pay if you sell off the public domain to the creditors. And so what you're having now is a vast global foreclosure process where the creditors and the bondholders are taking their payment in the form of domestic roads, transport system, communications, water and sewer, all the infrastructure. And that is what is leading to, that's why I call this neo-feudalism. It's leading rolling back industrial capitalism. It's rolling back the growth in markets to economic shrinkage and neo-feudalism, and that's what a rentier economy is. It's a rent extraction economy, not an economy earning profits by producing more and hiring labor to produce and expand the economy. It's the reverse of the dynamic of industrial capitalism as everyone thought of it a century ago.
Michael Hudson, thank you very much.
Well, it's always great to be on your show, and I'm glad you're back, Bonnie.
There's something happening, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
I've been speaking with Dr. Michael Hudson. Today's show has been The New Global Financial Cold War. Dr. Hudson is a financial economist and historian. He is president of the Institute for the Study of Long-Term Economic Trend, a Wall Street financial analyst, and distinguished research professor of economics at the University of Missouri-Kansas City. His 1972 book, Super Imperialism, The Economic Strategy of American Empire, is a critique of how the United States exploited foreign economies through the IMF and World Bank. He is also author of Trade, Development, and Foreign Debt, and The Myth of Aid, among many others. His latest book is Killing the Host, How Financial Parasites and Debt Destroy the Global Economy. Dr. Hudson acts as an economic advisor to governments worldwide, including Iceland, Latvia, and China, on finance and tax law. Visit his website at michael-hudson.com. That's michael-hudson.com.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. Today, the show is about climate change. Here, seldom is heard an encouraging word. But we do have some encouraging words today from climate scientist Tim Flannery. I hope you'll stay tuned. I try to keep a sense of humor about things, but if New World Notes has a fault, that's a joke. The show has about 75 faults. Anyway, if the show has a fault, it is that our installments sometimes are a bit heavy on the gloom and doom, especially when we discuss the ongoing, the unrelenting destruction of the Earth's environment. Global climate change. So, it was a rare delight to find a serious climate scientist who says that the situation is plenty bad, for sure, but maybe we can avoid total disaster. Dr. Timothy Flannery. Tim Flannery is an Australian environmental scientist and climate change activist. He has a new book on the subject, titled Atmosphere of Hope: Searching for Solutions to the Climate Crisis. He spoke in Seattle a few weeks ago, in November 2015. Mike McCormick captured the audio of his talk, and I have whittled the hour-long presentation down to about 25 minutes. Flannery offers a large handful of partial solutions. Several of these are high-tech and not yet tested on a large scale. But importantly, these high-tech solutions are not like the scary and dangerous geoengineering schemes that our industrial and military technocrats keep coming up with. Some of the solutions are here now. Solar electricity and windmill electricity are established. They're cheaper than coal, and they work. On the other hand, turning atmospheric CO2 into carbon fiber, well, that technology is not ready for prime time just yet. But it's doable, and it has been done on a small scale. None of these technologies is adequate in itself to halt global climate change. All of them together might still not be good enough. But what the heck, at least they offer and warrant some real hope. At least they could buy us some time to work out better solutions. We will skip over Flannery's own catalog of gloom and doom and pick up at the point where he shifts to the hopeful stuff. Here is Tim Flannery.
So what's changed that gives me hope? I just want to talk about one relatively small thing first, but I think it's quite telling. The International Energy Agency earlier in the year produced a report that really surprised me. And it surprised me because the International Energy Agency is hardly some screaming radical green organisation. You know, it has its own coal unit and its experts in fossil fuel use and all the rest of it. So the report they produced was quite astonishing. What it said, or the bottom line of the report, was basically that in 2014, the global economy grew at a time when emissions from the burning of fossil fuels for energy use stalled. So the fossil fuels we consumed for energy use didn't grow between 2013 and 2014, and yet the global economy grew. This was astonishing to me because we're used to seeing developed countries decouple economic growth from emissions growth. The US has done it, Australia's done it, Canada's done it, Europe's done it. But to think that it would happen at the global scale in 2014 is amazing. No one was expecting that decoupling to occur so early. Two of the drivers, I think, that are responsible for that outcome are, first, incredible success of clean energy technologies in terms of penetrating the marketplace. And secondly, what I'll call for the moment energy efficiency, but we'll come back to that. Just to deal with the clean energy first, you know, I've watched year on year as solar panels have been producing cheaper and cheaper electricity. You know, for the last 30 years, they've dropped the price of electricity 10% a year. They've got, you know, it's amazing outcomes. The wind sector has been the same, and the wind sector and solar have got a long way to go. Costs are going down. I work with Siemens, or I have worked with Siemens for a decade, and particularly their wind sector, and I see what they're doing. I mean, they're totally revolutionising the production of wind turbines. They no longer have gears in their wind turbines. They have these gearless wind turbines where the head itself is the turbine. There's hundreds less moving parts. The maintenance costs are way, way down. The blades of wind turbines run out, obviously, and have to be replaced. They're like propeller blades on an aeroplane. You know, they start to corrode over time. What Siemens are doing with these, and imagine a 90-metre-long turbine blade, you know, they're putting little 3D printers on the blades that run all the way up and back and just keep that blade in absolutely top condition. So, again, maintenance costs are down. If you're putting your turbines offshore, that counts a lot. The least maintenance you need to do, the better. So the cost of electricity from wind turbines in future is going to be about half of what it is now. So, I mean, these technologies are just taking over the marketplace. For 3 years running, we've had more investment in clean tech than we've had in fossil fuels in the energy sector. It's just it's an enormous change. So that's part of that decoupling, I think. But the other part that I would argue is at least as important as what I called energy efficiency. In this country, your year of peak oil demand is way, way in the past. In my country of Australia, our year of peak coal demand was 6 years ago. You know, so all of those efficiency gains means that we're using less and less fossil fuels, which is getting us, you know, helping contribute to that decoupling that I mentioned. And I think we deserve a pat on the back. It's nights like this where everyone gets together who has been doing this sort of stuff. We need to recognise we've had a massive success. As kind of tedious as it is doing all of those small things that seem to not add up to anything, they've actually added up to a huge outcome in my view. So I think that's really important. 5 years before the Paris meeting agreement will start to take effect, which is 2020, we're seeing this decoupling. It might just buy us some time that we didn't think we had to get below 2 degrees. But as I said, there's enough gas in the air now to take us to 1.5 degrees of warming, and I really hate that. I hate that fact. I really do, because it's going to cost me my barrier reef and my children the opportunity to see that marvellous thing. And my third cause of hope really came from a meeting that I had in 2007 with Sir Richard Branson. He had read The Weathermakers and invited me to Necker Island, where he has a house, and wanted to talk about climate change and what he could do about it. Back then, I was pretty optimistic we were going to get a good outcome at Copenhagen and we'd be able to get on top of this problem. Richard didn't believe that for a second. He just said, I just don't think that humanity is capable of doing what needs to be done to avoid the problem. He said, what I'd like to do is to set up a prize for technologies that have the capacity to draw enough CO2 out of the air to make a difference to our climate future. So we ended up calling it the Virgin Earth Challenge Prize. It's a £25 million prize, and it's for technologies that have the potential to draw 1 gigaton of carbon out of the atmosphere per annum. Now, when he set that up in 2007, I agreed to be a judge on the prize panel, but I was very pessimistic that we'd get entries that would amount to anything. 8 years later, we've had 11,000 entries. I've looked through them, I've carefully evaluated them, and I have become totally convinced that this approach of drawing CO2 out of the atmosphere is going to be an indispensable part of our future. One of the things I found frustrating was that this wasn't being recognised anywhere. We didn't even have a name for this basket of technologies before. You know, some of the approaches people would refer to as geoengineering, others to agricultural practices and so forth, but there wasn't a name. So when I wrote my book, I thought I'll coin a name for this. I'll call it the third way. The reason I called it the third way is that the first and most vital way is reducing emissions. We all recognise that. That's what we've got to do. The second way, however, is geoengineering, but geoengineering in really damaging ways. And I can see that the second way will be used if we dally much longer in this. And let me just explain the sort of geoengineering that people are considering at the moment. One of the options, and probably the cheapest and most widely favoured option, is to inject some sort of sulphur-based chemicals into the stratosphere, which is, you know, 12 kilometres or so above our head, up where the jetliners fly. If you do that, you have an instant effect cooling the planet. We know that because large volcanoes sometimes erupt sufficient sulphur into the stratosphere to cool Earth, and we get these years without a summer. We know that happens. There's enough research being done on those options to show that it's really quite cheap. There's a few people who are probably living within 20 miles of us now who could individually fund a geoengineering proposal like that would change the climate of the Earth. It's not that expensive, and there's probably more than one that could do it. So we know it's cheap. We know it's instantly effective, right? Really does lower the temperature straight away. So if you're facing some dire problems related to temperatures, you can fix them. The third thing we know about the second way, geoengineering, using sulphur and so forth, is that it is incredibly dangerous. It's dangerous because it has the potential to change Earth's weather circulation patterns. So we know that if you put sulphur into the stratosphere, you will affect the South Asian monsoon. There's 1.4 billion people who depend upon that monsoon for a living. We know that the productivity of crops will decline. It's what's happened in years without a summer in the past when the sulphur's gone up naturally. And we know that underneath that sulphur, the problem of climate change will just keep festering away. The CO2 will keep increasing, the oceans will acidify, the very basis of life itself will be eroded. And if anyone decides that they've got to stop putting the sulphur up precipitously for any reason, the rebound in the climate system is likely to be extremely dangerous. The bad news is that there are a number of government agencies worldwide working on geoengineering solutions. The government of China alone has 4 major institutes or 4 major research groups working on these geoengineering solutions. China's likely to be quite severely affected by climate change, and China is run by technocrats and engineers who understand that problem very well, and they're hedging their bets. So the second way is something we want to avoid. The third way technologies I outline in the book are really different from the second way. They're all characterised by approaches, methods or technologies that strengthen Earth's self-regulatory system by pulling excess CO2 out of the atmospheres in ways that the Earth system already uses or in ways that basically simulate or mimic the way the Earth system operates. So it's dealing with the problem at base. I want to explain about some of those 11,000 solutions that we've seen in the prize and also some others that have come in subsequently. All of the approaches, all of the third way approaches really fall into two basic categories. One is, I can call the biological pathways. They depend upon sunlight as their power source and plants as the capture mechanism. They're really, really well understood. You know, reforestation, growing plants and somehow storing the carbon. I think that first example I gave you about Australia and how many trees you need to plant to draw down 4 gigatons gives you a sense of the limits of the biological systems, though. You know, we're already asking Earth's system, particularly its land-based ecosystems, to feed us and house us and clothe us, provide our clean water and fresh air and everything else. So there are limits to the amount I think we can do on land when we're dealing with a problem that is of many gigatons in scale. I think they'll contribute, but I don't think they'll be the full answer. So reforestation, it'll be an important tool, but it won't provide the full answer. It can't. It's just not of a scale that allows it to do it. The biochar industry, fantastic industry, and there's been great advances made here in the US and other parts of the world, is another option. And with biochar, you take plant matter, turn it into charcoal, put it in the soil, and the carbon will stay there long term, so it's out of the atmosphere, drawn out by the plants and then put into the soil. The old wood chemistry industries that used to be so prolific in this country might make a comeback. You know, before we had the petrochemical industries, we got all of our, you know, plastics and many of our other chemicals from the old wood chemical industry. Chemists knew how to take cellulose and various other plant products and make a lot of valuable products from them. It may be that we'll start doing that at scale. Maybe that'll get us some gigatons, but it won't get us anywhere near where we need to be. You really have to leave the land surface and go to the oceans if you want to have great opportunity in terms of this. But with that great opportunity comes a vast increase in the unknowns and the uncertainties. The seaweed that grows off the coast here in Seattle, that can grow at the rate of half a metre a day. It grows 30 to 60 times faster than any land-based plants. And there was a great study done last year suggesting that if we could only cover 9% of the world's oceans in seaweed farms, we could draw down all of the atmospheric CO2 we put up in any one year. So offset completely the current emissions. And also, because the seaweed takes CO2 out of the atmosphere and buffers the ocean waters and makes them less acid, we could grow enough high-quality protein in the form of fish and seashells and prawns to give 200 kilograms per year to a population of 10 billion people. So I thought, that's fantastic. This sounds like the silver bullet that we've all been looking for, you know. But then I started looking into the problem a bit and thinking about it a bit more seriously. 9% of the world's oceans turns out to be a not insubstantial area. It's about 4.5 times the size of Australia, to be honest. So, you know, we have about 500 square kilometres of seaweed farms off China when there's mixed aquaculture and seaweed farming. We sort of know how they work, but to go from that to even 1% of the world's ocean is an unbelievably large exercise. And then, you know, it occurred to me, what would we do with all of that seaweed? Are we just going to have it laying around in rotting piles or what? One option that's available is you could put the seaweed into biodigesters and you know, make methane, which you'd then burn for electricity and send the electricity onshore, and then maybe take the CO2 from the tailpipe, and where would you put it? Well, one option that's only a desktop study at this moment is that you could try to put it in sediments in the ocean, maybe 1 or 2 miles down, and at that depth, the CO2 remains liquid. The pressure of the water column above it means that the CO2 doesn't try to escape all the time. So it's quite different from putting CO2 into land-based rocks, where, you know, there it's buoyant, it wants to escape. But in the ocean, that's not the case. And eventually it would form a solid in those sediments. But this is all just thinking. It's desktop at the moment. But it's possible. I want to just go now to the chemical-based technologies, which are the second great silo, really, of third-way approaches. I call them chemical because they're very, very broad, but they all have one thing in common. They need an energy source, right? And that energy source at the moment is human-created electricity or transport fuels, you know, fossil fuels, to some extent. The first that we need to think about is carbon-negative concretes. I don't know whether any of you have heard of these, but the concrete industry globally is responsible for about 5% of current emissions of greenhouse gases. People have invented this new product called carbon-negative concrete, which over its lifetime, as it sits there and cures, it absorbs CO2 into its structure, so it gives us a gain in terms of reducing CO2. Its manufacturers claim that it's, you know, cheaper, stronger and more durable than conventional concretes. So why aren't we all rushing out to use carbon-negative concretes? Well, tragically, or perhaps not so tragically, engineers and others involved in building things are pretty conservative in their approach. They know what Portland cement-based concretes do, and we've got a history going back to Roman times. We know the stuff stands up, right? So no one's going to go out and build a Sydney Harbour Bridge or a World Trade Centre out of carbon-negative concrete at the moment because it doesn't have a track record, you know. But there are things we could do to try to foster that industry. If we had a sectoral cap-and-trade system just on the concrete sector, that would encourage the manufacture of carbon-negative concretes in low-risk environments where we could learn about its behaviour over time and start giving it that track record that it needs to start replacing Portland cement-based concretes. So there's a huge opportunity there. That opportunity really is on the gigaton scale. The second opportunity in the chemical pathways involves a particular rock type called serpentinites. And I suspect there's quite a lot of serpentinites in this area. They're rocks that form at the mid-ocean ridge, and over geological time they get incorporated, some of them at least, into continents and become just part of the, you know, landscape around us. As those serpentinites weather, they capture CO2 from the atmosphere, and it's a really important part of nature's way of getting rid of CO2 out of the system. If you could quarry and grind up 5 or 6 gigatons of serpentinite, you'd capture 3 or 4 gigatons of CO2. So it's quite a substantial amount. But, of course, the way we quarry things today, you've got to, you know, burn fossil fuels, basically, to drive those trucks and then drive the hammers. It'll break the stuff up, or the mills that break the rock up. But serpentinite is not just a kind of a desktop study. There is a company in the Netherlands at the moment who makes roofing paint, who includes serpentinite in their roofing paint and sells carbon-negative roof paints. Great idea. Never going to add up to a gigaton, but it's a good start. But there are people who are thinking, well, why don't we grind this stuff up on scale and use it to replenish beaches, use it as a substitute for beach sand, because in an active environment like that, it'll start sequestering quite a lot of CO2. Other people think we can use it in playgrounds or as a soil amendment. There's yet others who think maybe we could use serpentinite in the smokestacks of shipping, so that you could capture CO2 from a smokestack, but then drop the serpentinite into the oceans where it'll continue to absorb CO2 out of the ocean water. There's a lot of options there. And I think the greener that we can make our energy sector, the more prospective these opportunities look. You don't want to be burning fossil fuels to capture CO2, but if we can green up our electricity generation and our transport, then I think there's some real opportunities. The other options they're kind of much more prospective, but I do want to just cover off on them. I've held in my hand a little mobile phone cover made of plastic that was created out of atmospheric CO2. I know it's probably the most expensive mobile phone cover in the known universe. In fact, it certainly is, but it exists. You know, people are making plastics out of carbon dioxide drawn from the atmosphere. There's capture mechanisms that are very well known. We can incorporate the CO2 into products. It all takes energy, of course, but those plastics are solidified atmospheric CO2. They're a great way of getting CO2 out of the atmosphere and storing it. If every bit of plastic we created today was made out of atmospheric CO2, you would need to double world plastic production to pull a gigaton of carbon out of the atmosphere. That's about 4 gigatons of CO2. But it'll contribute, I think, over time. Just in the last 2 months, we heard about another fantastic breakthrough the manufacture of carbon fibres from atmospheric CO2. Now, here in Seattle, you've got to know about carbon fibres. Boeing uses them in their Dreamliner, you know, as the skin of the aircraft. They'd be more widely used if they were cheaper, right? But they're expensive. This technology of creating carbon fibres out of atmospheric CO2 is reported to be able to create those fibres at a fraction the cost of current production methods. Some estimates may be a tenth the cost. That's a massive breakthrough because once carbon fibres get cheap enough, they'll start competing head-on with aluminium and steel, and they're both really energy and carbon-intensive sectors. So they're taking a problem, atmospheric CO2, and turning it into a very powerful solution. I think, you know, who knows where that'll lead? Who knows? It's just a bare announcement at the moment, but I think there's real potential there. At the other wacky end of the scale, I need to mention this, but the South Korean researchers about 6 weeks ago made an announcement that they had discovered a way of activating used coffee grounds to capture atmospheric methane, right? Something I never occurred to me in my whole life could be possible, but they have done it. And, you know, I guess if the Arctic starts melting and lots of methane goes in the atmosphere, we'll all be drinking 100 cups a day and sending the stuff off to South Korea to get activated, and hopefully we'll have some sort of solution. But I just bring it up because it tells you we're at the very beginning of an industry here. And think about it this way, that we know that the CO2 in the atmosphere now will be driving ever more disastrous climate change through to 2050 and beyond. We know that, right? And what that means, we know what the problem is that our children will be trying to solve in 2050, right? We know the third way technologies, at least some of them, are the only way forward to deal with this. But we know also that there's long development pathways for all of these industries. Wind and solar teach us that. You know, it's going to be 30 years before we're at scale with the most prospective of these industries. So we need to start investing now. We need to start reducing emissions at the same time we invest in third-way technologies so they're at scale when we use them. I tried to do an assessment of what I thought, a conservative assessment, I should say, of what I thought third-way technologies might be doing in terms of CO2 reductions by 2050. And I came up with a figure that was around about 40% of current emissions. If we can achieve that, it would be stunningly important because it'll help us avoid that 2 degrees of warming. But when I really asked myself honestly whether I'd done a good job with that, I began to doubt it because I thought, I don't know what 2050 is going to be like. I really don't. The only way I can begin to come at it is to throw myself back a century. So let me imagine I'm living in 1915 and I'm trying to imagine 1950 rather than living in 2015 and trying to imagine 2050. And if you do that thought experiment, it's very interesting because in my city of Melbourne in 1915, horse-drawn power was the power on the streets. There may have been a few very early motor vehicles, but horse-drawn power was doing most of the work. The maps that people would have looked at to understand the world in school in 1915 were sort of colour-coded maps that were of countries that were colour-coded according to the empires of Europe that had been there for centuries. There wasn't a single communist country on those maps. You know, the war that was being fought, and my grandfather fought in the First World War, the war that he fought was being fought with cavalry charges in 1915, in part. There wasn't a single tank on a battlefield anywhere in the world in 1915. There was a few biplanes flying up, you know, around the place, and they were used for surveillance, but the generals were saying, oh, they're not really as good as the cavalry surveillance we used to get in the good old days, you know. So imagine that mindset, and then imagine 1950. Nuclear weapons, jet aircraft, half the world living under communism. To someone living in 1915, that would have read as science fiction, right? The changes were just too vast. So when I think about 2050, I think about it in those terms, but also with the knowledge that social, technological and environmental change have all accelerated this century. So when I did a conservative estimate of what might be happening in 2015, I have to admit to myself, I think it is really well and truly conservative. I suspect we will be astonished by what our children will do in 2015, and they'll do it with tools that will utterly transform the total economy. The opportunity that's been created with the tech boom and the green energy boom so far will look like small beer compared with the challenge the third way presents, because we can count the outcome in gigatons. We know the scale. We know how broad-based these technologies are. They cover almost every sector of the economy. And we know that, you know, if we want to reduce atmospheric CO2 by just one part per million, that's 18 gigatons we've got to take out of the atmosphere. You know, we're already pretty much at 400 parts per million. We know that we started the Industrial Revolution at 280 parts per million. The scale of the challenge is massive, but I have no doubt that the third way can deliver real outcomes. So thank you very much. I'll finish there and take questions.
Australia's Dr. Timothy Flannery, sounding a rare note of hope on climate change. Now it's time for us to skedaddle. On behalf of our entire staff, this is Kenneth Doust, thanking you for listening to New World Notes. We come to you from the spacious underground studios of WWUH-FM, a community service of that beacon of light in darkest Connecticut, the University of Hartford. We're on the web at newworldnotes.blogspot.com. Illegitimi non carborundum. Try to speak the truth, and please come back again next week. Ciao.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, 9/11 wake up call.
I'm sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. No short.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Since 2016 is the year in which many people are saying that the economy will collapse, I thought it might be good to start the year out with a repeat of this show about the history of bankers and wars and assassinations. 9/11 was a false flag event carried out to rapidly move forward this agenda for the New World Order. So let's begin with this show about finances, bankers, war, and assassination. Today you're going to hear Michael Rivero, who does a radio show and website called WhatReallyHappened.com. He's going to be making the link between the bankers, wars, and presidential assassinations. While I don't agree with everything that Michael Rivero says on his website and radio show, I do think that this history of the bankers and wars is worth listening to. Every American should know this history. I was fascinated by it. You'll also find out how approximately 25% of America's land has been put up as collateral to foreign nations for our debt. So here he is, Michael Rivero, on a financial rant.
Now, I want to share a story with you, and this is actually an article that I wrote over the weekend called All Wars Are Bankers' Wars. And I went in, I did a lot of research, it's posted to the front page of whatreallyhappened.com. I understand it's already gone viral, it's being reposted around the web. But I wanted to basically tell it to you here on the radio show. But it's something that you need to understand, that all of these wars and assassinations that we're told are crazed loan nut assassins, or weapons of mass destruction, or bringing democracy, all of them track back to the private central bankers as the initiating event. And the more you study this, the more you will realize all the wars are wars for the bankers, for the private central bankers. And I know a lot of people are going to have difficulty comprehending this, just how many of these wars we have fought as a nation were fought for no other purpose than to force private central banks onto nations that did not want them. So we're going to have a few examples so you understand why at this particular time in history the United States government is mired in so many wars against so many foreign nations. And there's plenty of precedents for this. Now, going back to the beginning, the United States fought the American Revolution primarily over King George III's Currency Act, which forced the colonists to abandon their own government-issued currencies and conduct business only using printed banknotes borrowed at interest from the Bank of England. If you go back to the writings of Ben Franklin, direct quote, "The refusal of King George III to allow the colonies to operate an honest money system, which freed the ordinary man from the clutches of the money manipulators, was probably the prime cause of the revolution." That's Ben Franklin. Now, our public schools don't teach that because you're not supposed to know that the bankers were really behind the American Revolution. After the revolution, the United States adopted a revolutionary, radically different economic system in which the government issued its own value-based currency so that private banks couldn't skim the wealth of the people through interest-bearing banknotes. So the American Revolution was fought primarily to free the American people from King George III's Currency Act, which ordered them to conduct all business using printed banknotes borrowed at interest from the Bank of England. So the Bank of England was just raking in wealth from the labor of the American people in exchange for ink and paper. And that fueled the anger that led to the American Revolution. Your public schools don't spend a lot of time on that, but that was really what it was all about. So the revolution was over, the United States was born, but the private bankers are nothing if not dedicated to their schemes to acquire other people's wealth, and they knew full well how easy it is to corrupt a nation's leaders. Now, just 1 year after Mayor Amschel Rothschild had uttered his infamous, "Let me issue and control a nation's money, and I care not who makes the laws," private bankers succeeded in setting up a new private central bank called the First Bank of the United States, largely through the efforts of the Rothschilds' chief supporter in the United States, Alexander Hamilton. Now, this First Bank of the United States was founded in 1791, and by the end of its 20-year charter, the First Bank of the United States had almost ruined the nation's economy while enriching the bank's owners. As a result, Congress refused to renew the charter and signaled their intention to go back to a state-issued value-based currency on which the people paid no interest at all to any banker. This resulted in a threat from Nathan Mayer Rothschild against the U.S. government. Quote, "Either the application for renewal of the charter is granted, or the United States will find itself involved in a most disastrous war." End quote. Congress still refused to renew the charter for the First Bank of the United States, whereupon Nathan Mayer Rothschild railed, quote, "Teach those impudent Americans a lesson. Bring them back to colonial status," end quote. Financed by the Rothschild-controlled Bank of England, Britain then launched the War of 1812 to recolonize the United States and force them back into the slavery of the Bank of England's banknotes, or to plunge the United States into so much debt they would be forced to accept a new private central bank. And the plan worked. Even though the United States won the War of 1812, Congress was forced to grant a new charter for yet another private bank, issuing the public currency as loans at interest, the Second Bank of the United States. Once again, private bankers were in control of the nation's money supply and cared not who made the laws or how many British or American soldiers had to die for it. So once again, the nation was plunged into debt, unemployment, poverty by the predations of the private central bank, and in 1832, Andrew Jackson successfully campaigned for his second term as president under the slogan, "Jackson and No Bank." True to his word, Jackson succeeded in blocking the renewal of the charter for the Second Bank of the United States of America. And this was where that famous quote came from Andrew Jackson. Quote, "Gentlemen, I too have been a close observer of the doings of the Bank of the United States. I have had men watching you for a long time, and I am convinced that you've used the funds of the banks to speculate in the breadstuffs of the country. When you won, you divided the profits amongst you, and when you lost, you charged it to the bank. You tell me that if I take the deposits from the bank and annul the charter, I shall ruin 10,000 families. That may be true, gentlemen, but that is your sin. Should I let you go on, you will ruin 50,000 families, and that would be my sin. You are a den of vipers and thieves. I've determined to rout you out, and by the eternal God, I will rout you out." End quote. Andrew Jackson. Shortly after the charter for the Second Bank of the United States expired, there was an assassination attempt on Andrew Jackson, and it failed when both pistols used by the assassin, Richard Lawrence, failed to fire. Later on, Lawrence explained the motive for the assassination by saying that with President Jackson dead, money would be more plenty. So it was an assassination motivated by the interests of the bankers. Now, our public school system is as subservient to the bankers' wishes to keep certain history from you, just as the corporate media is subservient to Monsanto's wishes to keep the dangers of GMOs from you, and the global warming cult's wishes to conceal from you the fact that Earth has actually been cooling for the last 16 years. So it should probably be no surprise that the financial dimension of the Civil War are not well known to the average American. It's portrayed in our history books and our popular media as an internal dispute over slavery. But in fact, it was a war with global implications. When the Confederacy seceded from the United States, the bankers once again saw the opportunity for a rich harvest of debt and offered to fund Lincoln's efforts to bring the South back into the Union at 30% interest. Lincoln remarked that he would not free the black man by enslaving the white man to the bankers, and using his authority as president, issued a new government currency, the greenback. This was a direct threat to the wealth and power of the central bankers, who quickly responded. This is a quote from the London Times following Lincoln's issuance of the greenbacks. Quote, "If this mischievous financial policy, which has its origin in North America, shall become indurated down to a fixture, then that government will furnish its own money without cost. It will pay off debts and be without debt. It will have all the money necessary to carry on its commerce. It will become prosperous without precedent in the history of the world. The brains and wealth of all countries will go to North America. That country must be destroyed, or it will destroy every monarchy on the globe." So, goaded by the private bankers, much of Europe supported the Confederacy against the Union, with the expectation that victory over Lincoln would mean the end of the greenback. France and Britain seriously considered an outright invasion on the United States in support of the Confederacy, but they were held at bay by Russia. A little bit of history most Americans don't understand. Russia came to the aid of Lincoln's Union during this crisis. Now, at that time, Russia had just ended their serfdom system, and they had a state central bank similar to the system the United States had been founded on. Now, free of European intervention, the Union won the war, and Lincoln announced his intention to go on issuing the greenbacks. Following Lincoln's assassination, the greenbacks were pulled from circulation, and the American people forced to go back to an economy based on banknotes borrowed at interest from the private bankers. So finally, in 1913, the private central bankers of Europe, in particular the Rothschilds of Great Britain, the Warburgs of Germany, met with their American financial collaborators on Jekyll Island, Georgia, to form a new banking cartel with the express purpose of forming the Third Bank of the United States, with the aim of placing complete control of the United States money supply once again under the control of private bankers. Owing to hostility over the previous banks of the United States, the name of this third bank was changed to the Federal Reserve in order to grant the new bank a quasi-governmental image. But in fact, it is a privately owned bank. It's no more federal than Federal Express. In fact, last year, the Federal Reserve successfully rebuffed a Freedom of Information lawsuit by Bloomberg News on the grounds that as a private banking corporation and not actually a part of the U.S. government, the Freedom of Information Act did not apply to the operators of the Federal Reserve. So 1913 proved to be a transformative year for the nation's economy. First, with Congress' passage of the 16th Income Tax Amendment and the false claim it had been ratified. Here's another direct quote. "I think if you were to go back and try and find and review the ratification for the 16th Amendment, which was the Internal Revenue, the income tax, I think if you went back and examined that carefully, you would find that a sufficient number of states never ratified that amendment," end quote. That's U.S. District Court Judge James C. Fox in Sullivan versus United States, 2003. Later that same year, 1913, and apparently unwilling to risk another questionable amendment, Congress passed the Federal Reserve Act over the Christmas holiday 1913, while members of Congress opposed to the measure were at home. This was a very underhanded deal, as the Constitution explicitly vests Congress with the authority to issue the public currency, does not authorize its delegation, and thus would have required a new amendment to transfer that authority to a private bank. But pass it, Congress did, and President Woodrow Wilson signed it as he promised the bankers he would in exchange for generous campaign contributions. Now, President Wilson later regretted that decision. You've probably heard this quote before, but you're going to get it again. Quote, "I am a most unhappy man. I have unwittingly ruined my country. A great industrial nation is now controlled by its system of credit. We are no longer a government by free opinion, no longer a government by conviction and the vote of the majority, but a government by the opinion and duress of a small group of dominant men. That was Woodrow Wilson writing in 1919. Now, 1 year after the passage of the Federal Reserve Act, World War I started. And it is important to remember that prior to the creation of the Federal Reserve, there was no such thing as a world war. Now, World War I actually started between Austria-Hungary and Serbia, but quickly shifted to focus on Germany. Why Germany? They didn't start the war. Why was Germany the villain in World War I? Well, the real reason was their industrial capacity was seen as an economic threat to Great Britain. Great Britain's pound was already in decline at the time because too much economic emphasis was on banking and finance, and not enough was on agricultural development, industrial development, and infrastructure. It's very much like the situation we have in the United States right now. All the financial operatives, they want to play the Wall Street games, and other parts of the economy are being neglected. We've lost a great deal of our manufacturing. We're not the agricultural exporter we used to be because everybody's over there at Wall Street playing in that giant open-air casino. Now, pre-war Germany did have a private central bank, but it was under strict control by the German government to keep inflation at reasonable levels and to make sure that all of the German economy was being properly funded, just like Putin did with their central bank about a month ago. Under government control, by the German government, investment was guaranteed to internal economic development, and as a result, Germany had become a major manufacturing technological power. They were exporting products that Great Britain could not compete with. So in the media of the day, Germany was portrayed as the main opponent of World War I. And not just defeated, it was flattened. Now, following the Treaty of Versailles, Germany was ordered to pay the war costs of all the participating nations, even though Germany had not started that war. This amounted to 3 times the value of all of Germany itself. Germany's private central bank, to which the German government had gone deeply into debt to pay the cost of the wars, was allowed to break free of government control. That led to the massive inflation of the Weimar Republic, followed permanently trapping the German people in endless debt. And money speculators were running rampant. And it led to these situations where you had literally a whole basket full of paper notes to get a loaf of bread. Now, when the Weimar Republic collapsed economically, it opened the door for the National Socialists to take power. Their first financial move was to issue their own state currency, which was not borrowed from private central banks. It was based on a unit of value, not a unit of debt. Freed from having to pay interest on the money in circulation, Germany blossomed and quickly began to rebuild its industry. It was an amazing transformation to see. The media called it the German miracle. Time magazine lionized Hitler for the amazing improvement of life for the German people and the explosion of German industry, and they even named him Time magazine's Man of the Year in 1938. And then once again, Germany's prosperity and freedom from a private central bank loaning the public currency at interest became a threat to other nations and other powers. I have a couple of quotes here from Winston Churchill that tells you what was really going through the minds of Europe in the years leading up to World War II. Quote, "Should Germany merchandise again," which means do business, "should Germany merchandise again in the next 50 years, we have led this war, World War I, in vain." That was Winston Churchill writing in the Times in 1919. Another quote, quote, "We will force this war upon Hitler if he wants it or not," end quote. Winston Churchill in a 1936 radio broadcast. Quote, "Germany becomes too powerful. We have to crush it," end quote. Winston Churchill in November 1936 speaking to U.S. General Robert Wood. Quote, "This war is an English war, and its goal is the destruction of Germany." Winston Churchill, autumn 1939 broadcast. So it was all about economics and profitability. Now, Germany's state-issued value-based currency was also a direct threat to the wealth and power of the private central banks around the world. And as early as 1933, they started to organize a global boycott against Germany to strangle this upstart ruler who thought he could run his nation without a private central bank. Now, as had been the case in World War I, Great Britain and other nations threatened by Germany's economic power looked for an excuse to go to war. And as public anger in Germany grew over the boycott, Hitler foolishly gave them that excuse. Years later, in a spirit of candor, the real reasons for the war were made clear. Quote, "The war wasn't only about abolishing fascism, but to conquer sales markets. We could have, if we had intended so, prevented this war from breaking out without doing one shot, but we didn't want to." End quote. Winston Churchill to Harry Truman, March 1946. one more quote here. Quote, Germany's unforgivable crime before World War II was its attempt to loosen its economy out of the world trade system and to build up an independent exchange system from which the world finance couldn't profit anymore. We butchered the wrong pig, end quote. Winston Churchill writing in his book, The Second World War. Now, a little side note, we're going to actually step back in time to the years before World War II. Little bit of history a lot of Americans are still completely unaware of. And it involves a gentleman by the name of Marine Corps Major General Smedley Butler. In 1933, Wall Street bankers and financiers had bankrolled the successful rise to power of Hitler and Mussolini. Brown Brothers Harriman in New York, and they're still there. I saw them when I was there for the 9/11 anniversary. They were financing Hitler right up to the day war was declared with Germany. And these Wall Street financiers decided that a fascist dictatorship in the United States, based on the one Mussolini had in Italy, was going to be far better for their business interests than Roosevelt's New Deal, which threatened massive wealth redistribution to recapitalize the working and middle classes of America. So the Wall Street tycoons recruited General Butler to lead the overthrow of the U.S. government and install a Secretary of General Affairs who would be answerable to Wall Street and not the people, would crush social unrest and shut down all the labor unions. General Butler pretended to go along with the scheme, but then exposed the plot to Congress. So they recruited Major General, Marine Corps Major General Smedley Butler to lead this coup d'etat because Butler was very popular with the soldiers and his image as part of this move would help convince the military this was the right thing to do. Now, to his credit, Major General Smedley Butler, remembering his oaths to the Constitution, pretended to go along with the scheme, but then exposed the plot to the United States Congress. Congress, then as now in the pocket of Wall Street bankers, refused to act. When Roosevelt learned of the planned coup, he demanded the arrest of the plotters, but the plotters simply reminded Roosevelt that if any one of them were sent to prison, their friends on Wall Street would deliberately collapse the still fragile U.S. economy and blame Roosevelt for it. So Roosevelt was unable to do anything about this attempted coup d'etat until the start of World War II, at which time he prosecuted many of the plotters under the Trading with the Enemy Act. Now, mostly it was glossed over, or it was just a rumor, unfounded, it's wacko conspiracy theory, but in 1967, the congressional minutes of Smedley Butler's revelation to Congress of the coup were finally released to the public. You ever see this movie, 7 Days in May? Kirk Douglas and Burt Lancaster, about an attempted military takeover of the United States of America, was based loosely on this story. But of course, in the movie, the bankers being behind the Burt Lancaster character was completely removed from the script here. Now, Smedley Butler is also famous for writing a work called War is a Racket, and I would like to read you a quote from that. Quote, I spent 33 years and 4 months in active military service as a member of our country's most agile military force, the Marine Corps. I served in all commissioned ranks from second lieutenant to major general. And during that period, I spent more of my time being a high-class muscle man for big business, for Wall Street, and for the bankers. In short, I was a racketeer, a gangster for capitalism. I suspected I was just part of a racket at the time. Now I'm sure of it. Like all members of the military profession, I never had an original thought until after I left the service. My mental faculties remained in suspended animation while I obeyed the orders of the higher-ups. This is typical with everyone in the military service. Thus, I helped make Mexico and especially Tampico safe for American oil interests in 1914. I helped make Haiti and Cuba a decent place for the National City Bank boys to collect revenues in. I helped in the raping of half a dozen Central American republics for the benefit of Wall Street. The record of racketeering is long. I helped purify Nicaragua for the International Banking House of Brown Brothers in 1909 through 1912. I brought light to the Dominican Republic for American sugar interests in 1916. In China in 1927, I helped see to it that the Standard Oil went its way unmolested. During those years, I had, as the boys in the back room would say, a swell racket. I was rewarded with honors, medals, and promotion. Looking back on it, I feel I might have given Al Capone a few hints. The best he could do was operate his racket in 3 city districts. I operated on 3 continents. General Smedley Butler, former U.S. Marine Corps commandant, and he wrote that in 1935. So, now moving forward here, as president, John Fitzgerald Kennedy understood the predatory nature of private central banking. He understood why Andrew Jackson fought so hard to end the Second Bank of the United States. So Kennedy wrote and signed Executive Order 11110, which ordered the U.S. Treasury to issue a new public currency called the United States Note. Now, Kennedy's United States notes were not borrowed from the Federal Reserve. They were created by the U.S. government and backed by the silver stockpiles held by the U.S. government. It represented a return to the system of economics the United States had been founded on, and it was perfectly legal for Kennedy to do so under the Constitution. All told, some $4.5 billion went into the public circulation, which eroded interest payments to the Federal Reserve and loosened their control over the nation. 5 months after signing Executive Order 11110, John F. Kennedy was assassinated in Dallas, Texas, and the United States notes pulled from circulation and destroyed. Following Kennedy's assassination, John J. McCloy, president of the Chase Manhattan Bank and president of the World Bank, was named to the Warren Commission. Now, I don't care how good a banker he is, he's not qualified to be investigating a murder, which is what we were told the Warren Commission was all about, to get the truth of the assassination. But we all know that the Warren Commission was there to cover up what was going on, and obviously we can presume safely that John J. McCloy's presence on the Warren Commission was to make sure the American public never got even a hint of the financial dimensions behind the assassination. So, as we enter the 11th year of what I am certain future history will most certainly describe as World War III, we need to examine the financial dimensions behind all these wars. Why are we here? Why are our children being killed and crippled? Is this another war for the profit of the private central bankers? And the answer is yes. Now, toward the end of World War II, when it became obvious that the Allies were going to win and dictate the post-war political environment, the major world economic powers met at Bretton Woods, a luxury resort in New Hampshire, in July of 1944, and they hammered out the Bretton Woods Agreement for International Finance. The British pound lost its position as the global trade and reserve currency to the U.S. dollar. There are indications this was part of the price demanded by Roosevelt in exchange for the U.S. entry into the war. Now, absent the economic advantages of being the world's go-to currency, Britain was forced to nationalize their Bank of England in 1946. The Bretton Woods Agreement, ratified in 1945, in addition to making the dollar the global reserve and trade currency, obligated the signatory nations to tie their currencies to the dollar. The nations that ratified Bretton Woods did so on two conditions. The first was that the Federal Reserve would refrain from overprinting the dollar, basically as a means to loot real products and produce from other nations in exchange for ink and paper. It basically was an imperial tax imposed by the U.S. economic system on the rest of the world. That assurance of no overprinting was supposedly backed up by the second requirement, which was that the U.S. dollar would always be convertible back to gold by the U.S. government at $35 an ounce. Now, of course, the Federal Reserve, being a private bank and not answerable to the U.S. government, did in fact start overprinting paper dollars, which were sent to other nations around the world, and under Bretton Woods, they had to send back products and produce and raw materials at full value. And much of the perceived American prosperity of the 1950s and 60s was the result of these foreign nations having to send real raw materials, goods, produce, back to the United States in exchange for these little pieces of paper with ink all over them, because they were forced to accept these paper notes as being worth $35 per ounce of gold. Then in 1970, France started looking at this huge pile of printed paper notes sitting in their bank vaults, for which real French product like wine and cheese had been traded, and it notified the United States government that they would exercise their option under Bretton Woods to return all those paper notes for gold at the agreed-upon $35 per ounce exchange rate. The problem was the United States had nowhere near the gold to redeem all those paper notes. So on August 15, 1971, Richard Nixon temporarily, nudge, nudge, wink, wink, say no more, suspended gold convertibility of the U.S. Federal Reserve notes. This Nixon shock, as it was termed at the time, effectively ended Bretton Woods, and many global currencies started to delink from the U.S. dollar. And it created another problem, because the United States had been collateralizing their loans, money borrowed from other governments and foreign investors, with the American nation's gold reserves. And with the awareness that there wasn't enough gold to redeem all the Federal Reserve notes, lenders to the U.S. were starting to wonder, did the U.S. government have enough gold to cover, collateralize their outstanding debts? Foreign nations began to get very nervous about the loans to the United States, and they were understandably reluctant to loan any additional money without some form of collateral. So what Richard Nixon did is he founded the environmental movement. with the EPA and its various programs like wilderness zones and roadless areas and heritage rivers, wetlands, and all these other little different programs, which all took vast areas of public lands and made them off limits to the American people, who are technically the owner of all those lands. But Nixon had no concern for the environment, and the real purpose of this land grab, under the guise of the environment, was to pledge those pristine lands and their vast mineral resources as collateral on the outstanding national debt. The multitude of all these different programs was simply to conceal the scale of the land grab and collateralization of the American people's heritage. And it actually today covers almost 25% of the entire nation, is now locked up by these EPA programs and pledged as collateral on government borrowing.
You've just been listening to the first of a two-part financial rant by Michael Rivero of the website whatreallyhappened.com. Tune in next week to hear the second and final part of this fascinating financial timeline of bankers, backroom deals, wars, and assassinations. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, building bridges.
This is Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg.
My city of ruin, now the sweet bells of mercy drip through the evening trees. Young men on the corner like scattered streets, all my brothers down on his knees. My city of ruins. My city of ruins.
And sometimes Bruce Springsteen hits it just right. My city in ruins. Rise up. It's like living in some sort of dystopian novel, Sean Crawford writes, to find National Guard troops going door to door delivering drinking water on his street. My hometown of Flint has been known for many things through its history. First, as the birthplace of General Motors and subsequently as the battleground of the Flint sit-down strike that formed the United Auto Workers and gave rise to a wave of union organizing across the country and to the middle class. The quality of life that Flint residents struggled for and enjoyed was once the envy of the world. Sean Crawford, Flint resident auto worker, whose grandfather was vice chair of the historic Flint sit-down strike, and Claire McClinton, member of the Flint Democracy Defense League, join us now against the backdrop of My City in Ruins, Bruce Springsteen. And I should say that we're also speaking to Sean while he's on his early morning shift at the auto plant that he works in. Sean, I just want to take a minute to set the pace. You come from an extraordinary family. Your great-grandfather, actually, was the vice chair of the historic Flint sit-down strike. And I know your grandmother was actively involved. Just tell us a little bit about that and how that set your consciousness for the work that you continue to do today. And it tells us everything about the indomitable spirit of the working class in Flint.
What a great introduction. Thank you. My great-grandfather was the vice chair of the Flint sit-down strike at Fisher One. Although I never met him, I feel like I got to know him very well through his two daughters, my great-aunt Geraldine Blankenship and grandmother Louise Crawford. Along with my mother, Jeanette, they raised me, and they were, until very recently, the last surviving members of the Women's Emergency Brigade, which was the woman's arm of the UAW sit-down strike that fought back against the company police and helped win the sit-down strike back in 1936 and 37. And they were a fantastic influence on my life. You know, they were Great Depression babies. They saw so many struggles in their lives, so many things that were, they probably seemed insurmountable at the time. I remember hearing stories about my great-grandfather having been pushed down a flight of stairs, having his jaw broken by the union-busting thugs that GM was hiring at the time. And yet, despite all that, they still fought through it all and ended up forming the United Auto Workers Union that won working-class people so much more respect and rights in the workplace, the ability to speak out about grievances and safety issues and things that were very pertinent to their lives, and set off a wave of organizing all across the country. And the stories that I heard from them growing up had a huge influence over who I became and gave me my moral compass, and I'm extremely grateful for that.
And so are we, to have you with us and to have somebody of that lineage. And Claire McClinton is hardly any newcomer to the struggle. Again, she's a member of the Flint Democracy Defense League. And Claire, I want you to begin to tell us a little bit about how Flint really became ground zero for corporate globalization and what have been the consequences for the Flint residents. And again, thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me. Flint is a ground zero for corporate globalization. We have been decimated in the auto industry, and just like a lot of the other Rust Belt, industrial manufacturing, factory life, and the great jobs that we once knew have been turned topsy-turvy. We have almost been driven back into the Stone Age. There have been tremendous plant closings. Population has shrunk. Many of the places around Flint look like war zones from the plant closings and the terrible economic assault on us that's been driven by technology and the transfer of good jobs overseas.
Sean, I want to go back to your description and give people that we opened with. This was some sort of a dystopian novel, the idea of National Guard troops delivering water. But we can't even begin up here to understand, unless you paint a picture for us, of what it means to have no water. We're talking no water. It's not a matter of just bringing in bottled water. It's a matter of
Can you brush your teeth? Can you wash your dishes? Can you wash? What happens because the polluted, toxic water leaches into the body? So tell us what it's been like to begin, how this happened, and the correlation between what happened and corporate greed and the usurpation, frankly, of local government. So what's it like there? What's going on?
Well, back in April of 2014 was when we first switched to the Flint River. The river water is incredibly corrosive. What that did is that leached a lot of the heavy metals from our aging plumbing system and brought it into our homes. So periodically, over the last couple of years, there have been instances where the water literally ruins rust color or brown. See fire hydrants open down the streets just gushing with this brown or rust-colored water periodically. And it's, they tell you, don't drink it. And so you have to wait for it to be flushed out of the system, wait till it runs clear, but then you still look at it in a suspect manner. And there's good reason for that. But yet at the same time, city officials and state officials were assuring us, don't panic. Everything's fine. You can keep drinking it. It meets all federal and state standards. Unfortunately, I was one of those folks that was naive enough to believe government officials that told me that it was safe to drink. And up until recently, when a local physician revealed that many people were being poisoned with lead, I believed them. So other than when I could visually detect that the water was brown or rust-colored, I was drinking the water. You know, I often wonder about what the long-term health effects are going to be from it's been so widespread and so many people have been exposed to these heavy metals and we're all be. Currently, I know the American Red Cross, National Guard have hit every home in the city twice with water filters and bottled water, although whether or not they actually reach those people is still in question. I know that they're scaling back currently. But when you go outside, I have we're using our fire stations as distribution centers. And every day you drive by, I mean, you see National Guard troops. I mean, shoot, the other day I had a military helicopter. It looked like it was about to land above my house. It just hovered there for a minute. I went outside. It was incredibly loud. The noise was almost deafening. I'm still wondering what the effects are going to be for me. And, of course, I don't consume anything now without any kind of a filter on it. Obviously, I use just bottled water. As far as showering, bathing, doing the dishes, quite honestly, where are you supposed to go? What are you supposed to do? You still use it, and you kind of look at it, and, well, I hope I'll be okay. What are your options?
Hmm. Well, that is the question. And Claire, Flint, which is now under a transition advisory board, as an interim step towards return to local control, was placed in receivership under an emergency manager appointed by Governor Schneider in 2011. The city, which had previously purchased Lake Huron water through the Detroit Water and Sewerage Department, began drawing its water from the Flint River in April 2014. Now, the city stuck with the river water despite months of complaints from residents about the poor taste and color of the water, among other concerns, as Sean was mentioning. Talk to us more about that and the issue of the emergency manager, which I know that you and Sean certainly blame for what has happened and the crisis that is now upon the Flint residents.
Even though this issue of our poison water has received national as well as international attention, the untold story of our poison water is the poison system in which Flint and 17 other school districts and municipalities live under. The governor sent an emergency manager to Flint, presumably under the guise that our city was in a financial distress and needed this strongman to come in and fix our finances. The emergency manager was given extraordinary powers, and I can reduce those down to two main functions of, and that is to, one, is to sell off our public assets of our services. And this individual had the power to just write an order. We call them edicts, and sell off parks. We had beautiful golf courses here. They sold our senior citizen centers, privatized our garbage collection, and on. But the experiment of this political model that's been imposed on the city of Flint is what led to the poisoning of our water. As they're trying to build a new pipeline, creating regional authorities, and stealing our waters, that's what led to this disaster. And that is the untold story about what's happening to Flint, Michigan.
And Sean, Flint was under the control of a state-appointed emergency manager when it began drawing water from the Flint River as a cost-saving measure last year, I believe. And, of course, you've indicated and tests now show the corrosive nature of the river water caused lead in the pipes that deliver it to homes and other structures to leach into the drinking water, causing it to exceed federal limits for lead, which can cause certainly permanent brain damage in children. So now Michigan's emergency manager law, which was highly controversial because it was rejected by voters in 2012, was actually reinstated by Republican lawmakers less than 6 weeks later. And now it's under fresh scrutiny. But to begin with, how does this happen? How do you take a place like Flint with the kind of social activism, labor history that it has, and wind up in this situation with this emergency manager law, which both you and Claire are blaming for the Flint water crisis?
Well, I think it's definitely a piece of a much broader struggle to strip the working class and the poor of political power in the United States. Well, you mentioned the original emergency manager law being repealed and then a similar law coming up 6 weeks later. Well, right around that same time, when Governor Snyder reintroduced the new version of the emergency manager law, he also introduced a right-to-work law in Michigan, which we protested vigorously and basically shut down the Capitol. It was one of the most memorable protests I had ever been to. He did that despite widespread public opposition. Thought that there was blood in the water, and he said, hey, I can do this politically. Let's get it done. Screw what the citizens of Michigan say. And so this is just, one of the things that needs to be mentioned about the emergency manager law. One of the main powers they have is to renegotiate and terminate public labor contracts. And as probably many of your listeners know, that is the last bastion of union strength in our economy now. And so with these new emergency manager laws, they can just go and legally wipe that away, right? That in conjunction with the fact that we've had huge leaps in technology, which have displaced so many workers. We've had corporate globalization going on for so many years that have created these economic depressions. What it amounts to is an attack on the working class through right to work, through the emergency manager laws, ability to strip away public sector union. It's just an attack on the working class,
you know, part
of a broader political struggle.
One of the things that I remember that hit the news nationally is relevant to Flint with the emergency managers. There was a decision in Pontiac to sell the Silver Dome, the former home of the Detroit Lions. And that was in 2009 for $583,000. Then the investors who brought it said in 2014, they actually wanted to then sell it for $30 million. So there's this constant rationalization of bankruptcy and what's a poor city to do when it's squeezed fiscally, and thus these emergency management teams, etc. Claire, your response to, oh my goodness, what's a poor governor to do? What's a poor city to do when it's financially strapped? Doesn't it have to deal with these cost-saving devices?
And their zeal and quest to rob and steal the citizens of their publicly held commons, water being the main one. You know, they say that water is the new oil. And these are public assets that are being stripped away from the people. We have no control. Our democracy, as we've known it, has been taken from us. The dismantling of our democratic rights. This emergency manager law is voter suppression on steroids. In April of 2014, when we began our cries and everything about our hair is falling out, we're breaking out in rashes, major medical problems, dehydration. At the time, we did not know that we had lead in our water. This came out months later. Before that, we were dealing with E. coli. We were dealing with trihalomethanes and on and on and on, and it's just been a nightmare. But the grassroots people in the city of Flint have been resistant and stubborn and determined that we were going to resolve this issue. We are not scientists. We are not physicians. We're common, everyday, resilient people trying to make it through life. Because of that is how this whole scandal finally broke through for our story to be told.
You want a really great example of just how undemocratic this law is. You have to look at the fact that this happened when we first switched the Flint River water, when these protests first started. We were first complaining about the smell and the taste and the color, April 2014. When was a state of emergency declared? Finally, January of this year. That's how long it took for our government to be responsive to our needs and our complaints and our outcries. Okay, there's only one way that this could ever happen, and that is if you have a government that is wholly unresponsive to its citizens. You have an unresponsive dictator running your city, period. They don't care about the needs and the cries of the citizens. They only care about being responsive to the governor, and that's it. And he has been the political enemy of cities like Flint for so long. Why should he care about its citizens and what their needs are?
And now it's significant, I think, that in recent years, Michigan had six cities under emergency managers. So this is a lesson to be learned for the rest of the country. But before we get into that, I also want to ask about the Federal Emergency Management Agency recently approved an emergency declaration which could bring up to $5 million in direct funding to Flint, although billions seem to be needed. Federal officials denied declaring a disaster, which could have brought more money in, millions more. FEMA turned down the state's appeal. Claire?
The struggle continues. We are so encouraged by the national attention and the national response from people all over this country. Water is being brought in every day from little people putting cases of water in their car. And there were some young men that drove their car from Chicago, and they filled their car up with water, and they just brought it here and dropped it off to people. We've had celebrities and Cher and Michael Moore, and we just feel the love from all over the country. We have to continue to fight the failure to declare us a disaster area where we can get the Army Corps of Engineers super funds and on and so forth. There has not been one shovel dug to replace these pipes that are just destroyed from the corrosive Flint River. Even a fresh water source, going back to our original water source, which was Detroit, we were able to declare victory when we forced them to finally take us back to our original water source. But guess what? The corrosiveness of the pipes had gone far beyond even good water from Detroit. Could not stop the leaching. So we are encouraged by the humanity of our fellow citizens and everything, but we have to continue to fight. We want our home rule back. We want the feds to declare it a disaster area so we can return to some semblance of civilization here.
Sean, I know that you are speaking to us from your shift at an auto plant. We don't hear the machinery in a way, but trust me, he is there and taking some time away from his job. What needs to be done for the city? Is there a response from national labor in support of the citizenry? And what do our listeners need to do to support their sisters and brothers who are suffering this really stone age, as Claire said, situation in Flint?
I have to echo Claire's sentiment. I want to say thank you in a huge way to all the people who have been showing us the love and support that they have. It's really fantastic. You know, sometimes living in a city like Flint, you feel like you're being forgotten. That has been proven to me time and time again that that is absolutely not the case. So I just want to say thank you from all of us here in Flint for everyone's support and concern. That being said, you know, immediately, obviously, we need bottles of water, we need filters, but that is really just a short-term solution. Fundamentally, what we need to do is make sure our infrastructure is sound by replacing it or coming up with some sort of solution that will actually make the infrastructure usable again. And then beyond that, what we need to do is really have a revitalized movement for democracy in this country so emergency manager laws like this can be snuffed out when they start to pop up in other states, because I know that they are using Flint and Michigan as a kind of a canary in the coal mine. They're testing out these laws because so many of our cities have been so economically dispossessed for so long, they think they can get away with all this BS. And they're going to try it everywhere that they can. So I would say the number one biggest thing that people can do is watch out for emergency manager laws in your own communities, in your own states. Fight them tooth and nail. Make sure that this disease of dictatorship does not spread to other states, because things like this can happen. And then whatever we can do in this state to repeal the emergency manager law and restore democracy. And when we have it restored, participate as thoroughly as possible, not just through, you know, local democratic elections, but actually talking to your representatives, becoming involved in your union, and make sure that working class people and poor people really have a voice. I think this is a perfect opportunity to revisit something like this, you know, maybe like a Great Depression era idea of like the Civilian Conservation Corps. Why don't we bring back and rehire the unemployed workers in Flint who have so many skills and so many years of experience working in these auto plants and put them to work replacing some of this infrastructure and some of these faucets and pipes in people's homes so we can make Flint a habitable place to live again? Really, we're in a situation right now, a lot of us, we feel trapped. What if we want to leave someday? How are we going to be able to sell our homes? Where are we going to go? Is anyone ever going to want to move into our city? We need to figure out these problems and come up with creative solutions that actually benefit the citizens of Flint and not just temporarily show that we're not forgotten, but solve these long-term systemic economic issues that we've been facing for so many years.
Well, I think Sean summed it up beautifully, and I meant to mention that we were shocked and amazed in October of 2014. General Motors engine plant went to the emergency manager and said, "This river water is rusting our parts." They were immediately given permission to come off the Flint River water and go back to the Detroit water sources. And they haven't had a complaint since. But yet and still, when we said this water is affecting our health, it stinks, it smells like garbage, it smells like chlorine, at that point we knew that there were some chemical toxins in the water. Our governor and his state-appointed, unelected emergency manager refused to budge. So this is a wake-up call to all of us. And as a union town, we know that corporate management walks and the people just talk unless we fight back. We will refuse to go back to the Detroit source back early when something could have been done, and we were ignored. Our future is up to us about what kind of society that we want to have. What kind of life do we want to live? We don't want to pass on lead to our children and grandchildren. We want to pass on a good life to our children and grandchildren, one that this new technology that is being developed every day can make life better for all of us. And that's the kind of future me as a retiree from General Motors want to pass on to my children and grandchildren.
Well, you're really tearing at my sense of well-being, which should be happening. This is a wake-up call. We all must rise to the occasion of the needs of our sisters and brothers in Flint. This is just a striking, important lesson that both Sean Crawford and Claire McClinton have taught us, and they must immediately begin work on repiping the entire city of Flint. Anything else is unacceptable. I guess we all have to knock seriously on the doors of Washington, and we'll be doing that. I have to ask, what's your job on the line, Sean? What are you doing this morning?
I work as a team leader on the door line, so I mostly just do repairs and give bathroom breaks on car doors for the Chevy Sonics and Buick Veronicas we build here at Orion.
Well, Sean is a third-generation auto worker. Again, great thanks to Sean Crawford, auto worker, Flint resident, whose great-grandfather was vice chair of the historic Flint sit-down strike, and Claire McClinton, struggler extraordinaire, member of the Flint Democracy Defense League. We're going to see you down there, and we're going to see you in Washington, because this is a national problem, and we have to remedy it forthwith. Thank you so much for joining us, and stay strong.
Thank you for sharing it. Thanks. Hats off to you for that and your listeners.
Our pleasure.
Absolutely. Thank you.
My city of ruin. My city of ruin. Come on, rise up. 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 Come on,
Well, this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next.
This Way Out.
And said, okay, so look, it's been a while now, and not only have you not fixed this, but it's gotten worse. And I was sort of left to grapple with that. What does this say about God, that I would be this way and that God would not change this for me?
I had a boyfriend at the time and had kind of talked about, like, landing the best run ever and, like, winning an Olympic gold medal and, like, kissing him at the bottom. And I was like, that would be my way of telling everyone. But it didn't happen. I'm glad it didn't, actually, because I hadn't told my mom, my dad, my brothers. My family would have been like, what the hell?
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. A poisonous amendment threatens Italy's civil unions bill, trans studies matriculate at the University of Victoria, and faith groups tackle trans inclusion. Those stories and more this week, because you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Sarah Sweeney.
And I'm Wenzel Jones.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBT communities around the world for the week ending January 23rd, 2016. Consideration of a civil unions bill for same-gender couples began in Italy's parliament on January 21st with a proposal to jail gay couples that use surrogates abroad. Roman Catholic Church-affiliated senators from the majority Democratic Party attached the amendment to the civil union's draft law that would imprison violators of the surrogacy provision for up to 2 years and levy fines against them of up to €1 million. It would also require a same-gender couple to prove that their child was not conceived by a foreign surrogate and allow judges to remove children from their homes and put them up for adoption if they're found to have been conceived that way. Surrogacy is illegal in Italy. Gabrielle Piazzoni of the country's leading LGBT rights group, ArsaGay, called the amendment indecent, telling the Italian edition of The Local news website that a law intended to recognize rights cannot be transformed into a criminalizing one that talks about prison. Italy is the last major Western European country without any legal recognition of cohabiting same-gender couples. Previous civil union bills have been blocked by dozens of amendments from opponents. However, supporters believe they have the necessary votes for the latest version. Watch for massive rallies by both proponents and opponents of the bill before month's end.
The U.S. LGBT advocacy group, Lambda Legal, dropped its lawsuit against the Department of Veterans Affairs this week after the agency announced a new policy that recognizes the legally married spouses of all American lesbian and gay service members. The LGBT legal organization filed suit in federal court on behalf of the American Military Partner Association in 2014, challenging the different benefits available to the spouses of legally married same-gender service members, depending on whether or not their state of residence recognized the marriage. The U.S. Supreme Court's June 2015 ruling, opening civil marriage to same-gender couples in all 50 states, certainly helped push the official policy change. On its website, the Department of Veterans Affairs said that, "We encourage all veterans in same-sex marriages who believe they are entitled to benefits, including those whose claims were previously denied on a ground related to their marriage, to promptly apply for benefits."
The British government has closed a legal loophole that exempted 5 countries from having to issue death certificates that recognize the deceased's legally married same-gender spouse. When a British national now dies in Australia, Canada, Ireland, New Zealand, or South Africa and is in a marriage with a same-gender spouse, that spouse can be recognized as such on the death certificate. A story that broke earlier in the week sparked international outrage and prompted the change. Gay Brit David Bulmer Rizzi died on January 16th while honeymooning in Adelaide, South Australia, with his husband Marco Bulmer Rizzi after falling down a flight of stairs and suffering fatal injuries. Because the Australian state doesn't recognize the legal marriages of gay and lesbian couples, the widower was told that his husband's death certificate would read, "Never married." Marco told BuzzFeed that, "I wasn't the next of kin. Every single question I was asked, whether or not I wanted David cremated, whether or not I wanted David to have a service, even the cost of the coffin they were to use. After I gave my answer, David's father was consulted."
Nigel Bulmer, David's father, was supportive of the couple and highly critical of Australia, and also spoke with BuzzFeed. "It demeans my son's memory and denies their relationship," he said. "No one should ever have to go through what we've gone through. We're at the bottom and somebody has dug a deeper pit." Unlike several other states and territories, South Australia does not recognize the marriages of gay and lesbian couples legally performed overseas. Premier Jay Weatherill phoned Marco to personally apologize for the disrespect he and his late husband had suffered, telling London's Guardian newspaper that it was obviously awfully insensitive. He called on state lawmakers to pass a measure recognizing the marriages of same-gender couples performed elsewhere to prevent this kind of deeply shaming incident from happening again. A pending voter referendum will finally settle the contentious issue of Australian marriage equality nationwide.
Elsewhere, an Egyptian appeals court has freed Mona Iraki, the controversial TV journalist responsible for the arrest and televised humiliation of 26 presumably gay men in December 2014. Iraki tipped off police that a gay sex party was taking place at a Cairo bathhouse and then filmed the raid for her so-called undercover TV show. The near-naked male detainees were paraded before the cameras and then reportedly subjected to anal probes to determine whether or not they had engaged in homosexual activity. Virtually every reputable Western medical association calls that practice unscientific and useless. Human rights groups call it torture and a violation of international law. The bathhouse owner, his employees, and all 21 patrons caught up in the raid were acquitted in January 2015 of debauchery for lack of evidence. That charge is typically used against same-gender-loving people because there's no specific law against homosexual acts in the country. But the men have been the targets of ridicule, rejection, and abuse by both strangers and loved ones. One even tried to burn himself to death. An appeals court this week overturned Araki's conviction of defamation and spreading false news, although no specific legal reasons were reported. The TV journalist had been sentenced to 6 months in jail and a heavy fine. She has steadfastly refused to apologize. Her undercover program was canceled after worldwide condemnation of her actions. Daily News Egypt reports that Araki currently hosts another so-called investigative show called Attention on another privately owned TV channel.
In other news, Guatemala has its first out congressperson. Proud lesbian Sandra Moran, who's part of a progressive movement in the Central American country that supports the rights of indigenous Guatemalans and other underrepresented groups, was sworn in on January 14th. She'll represent Guatemala City. Moran lived for a time in Nicaragua and Canada to escape the country's bloody civil war, but returned home in 1994. She's become a prominent figure within the Guatemalan women's, feminist, and LGBT movements during the past two decades. She told the Washington Blade that there was a positive reaction to her campaign among LGBT Guatemalans because it was the first time there was a congressional candidate who is like them, she said. There would finally be a representation in the Congress from a sexually diverse background. She'll have her work cut out for her, however. Newly elected President Jimmy Morales, a comedian and political outsider, was also elected in October, ousting an incumbent mired in a corruption scandal. He's an evangelical Christian who opposes marriage equality and abortion. Moran told The Blade that Morales is racist, sexist, and homophobic.
The U.S. state of Minnesota has its first out Supreme Court justice. Governor Mark Dayton announced the elevation of appeals court judge Margaret Chudich to the state's highest court on January 22nd, telling the Associated Press that she's a phenomenal appointment. Chudich worked with both the state's attorney and the U.S. Attorney's Office before winning election to the appeals court. Gubernatorial appointments of state Supreme Court justices in Minnesota don't require legislative confirmation, although justices periodically need to be re-elected by the voters. Chudich told a media conference that courts need to reflect the communities they serve. If there are gay attorneys, gay people thinking about going to law school, she said, I think it's important that they know there aren't barriers to their dreams. According to Minnesota Public Radio, Colorado, Hawaii, Massachusetts, Oregon, and Vermont also have out justices on their state Supreme Courts.
As we first reported in a late-breaking news bulletin last week, Russian lawmakers rejected a proposal on January 18th that would have made coming out a crime. Lesbian and gay violators would have been fined for kissing a same-gender partner or other displays of affection in public. Similar statements or displays of non-traditional sexual relations near schools or youth services would have been additionally punished by up to 15 days in jail. But a legislative committee refused to advance the bill. The country's infamous 2013 law that bans promotion of gay propaganda to minors remains on the books, however. It has resulted in virtual bans of any pro-LGBT event, including pride celebrations. Human rights advocates also report that verbal and physical attacks against people perceived to be LGBT have spiked in the country since President Vladimir Putin signed that measure into law.
And finally, authorities in the Russian city of Arkhangelsk thought a rally honoring the gay smelt would violate that national no-promo-homo law. St. Petersburg has held a festival of smelt for centuries, honoring the small fish that is considered to be a staple of the Russian diet. LGBT organizers of the Arkhangelsk event had planned to display gay fish signage and also make the serious point that the smelt is being overfished. City officials also rejected the same organizers' request to hold a march to honor Iraqi and Syrian LGBT victims of ISIS. Activists ridiculed the officials for putting the tribute to a gay fish in the same category as a protest against extremism. But this is no fish story. One of the festival organizers, Moscow Pride founder and veteran activist attorney Nikolai Alexiev, said he was preparing a lawsuit to challenge the denial in Russian courts. He told reporters that, if necessary, he'll take his gay fish festival case all the way to the European Court of Justice.
That's NewsWrap for the week ending January 23rd, 2016. Produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
NewsWrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Sarah Sweeney.
And I'm Wenzel Jones.
Spirit and sport and coming out on top later in the program. The University of Victoria in the Western Canadian province of British Columbia announced the creation this week of the world's first chair in transgender studies. In a video on the university's website accompanying the announcement, Professor of Sociology Dr. Aaron DeVore, the chair's first occupant, outlined his credentials.
For the past 30 years, I have been working in the field of transgender studies. My early work was focused more on simply understanding some of the realities of the lives of transgender people, because that many years ago, we knew almost nothing. More recently, my work has been with the World Professional Association for Transgender Health, working on the standards of care, which are distributed internationally, to give guidelines for the appropriate care for transgender people.
The new Transgender Studies Chair was created by a close to $3 million Canadian dollar donation from Jennifer Pritzker, a wealthy transgender investor, philanthropist, and retired U.S. Army Lieutenant Colonel. Half of the gift from Pritzker's Tawani Foundation will support the chair for 5 years. The other half will match other donations to the program. Her hometown Tribune newspaper says Pritzker is part of a Chicago family best known for the development of the Hyatt Hotel chain and other companies in the Marmon Group. According to the University of Victoria media release, its transgender archives represents 17 countries on 5 continents, more than a century of research, and over 50 years of activism. Dr. DeVore reflected on how he was able to reach this milestone.
Over the years, I've been able to build a level of trust with both the transgender community, transgender activist community, and the researchers who work with the transgender community. When the time came to start the transgender archives, that proved to be very beneficial because I was able to reach out to both of those communities, and they responded favorably and now have donated enough of their precious archives to the transgender archives to make us the world's largest transgender archive.
He explained why the transgender community needs to have its own archives.
It's important for any people to know their history if they're going to have pride in who they are and to feel a sense of dignity in terms of who they are. So the Transgender Archives is a valuable resource to contribute to that because it is the one place that serves as a repository of the history of transgender activism and research.
Sociology professor Dr. Aaron DeVore, the inaugural chair in transgender studies at the University of Victoria. An Olympic skier talks about coming out, but first... There's good news for anyone praying for religious institutions to transition on gender issues. Richard Chappell has the story.
Transgender Welcome is a new resource booklet for faith communities published by the Center for American Progress. It's written by Bishop Gene Robinson with a colloquium of transgender and allied faith leaders. Robinson was the first out gay bishop of the recently suspended by the Anglican Communion Episcopal Church, and he introduced the resource booklet on January 19th in a dialogue with transgender Baptist pastor Allison Robinson.
What would you say is the biggest hurdle for a transgender person of faith in reconciling their faith with their gender identity?
I think that for many of us, the first and greatest challenge is simply to hold both an authentic understanding of our gendered selves and our understanding of ourselves as people of faith together. Rarely do both of those worlds survive. Typically, either one rejects their faith in order to embrace a wholeness and health that they've been seeking, or they seek to reject their gendered selves because they believe that that's what is required of them to be worthy of the love of God and of community. Even though many of us come from faith traditions that are broadly welcoming and enthusiastically affirming, we have to sort of acknowledge that, you know, we come from, in many ways, a social background and an ecclesiological background, which has some very rigid and strict ideas about gender roles, historically speaking. You know, we see these boundaries being policed in some of the very earliest of the ancient Hebrew texts that we have. Over time, you know, we have grown to claim for ourselves, to consciously choose for ourselves values of welcome and inclusion and equality. But those other things, those other ideas can be very deeply rooted within us. And so being around people who sort of flout those boundaries, right, can feel challenging, even when our values would indicate otherwise for us. I think we, all of us, trans people and the communities that seek to welcome us alike, we can take hope from the example of Jesus, who was also kind of all about flouting these boundaries.
You know, recently in Houston, with the repeal of the Equal Rights Ordinance for that city, we saw not gay or lesbian people being used, but transgender people being used to frighten people. And they had creepy old men wearing lipstick following young girls into the bathrooms. Why does that work?
I think that the reason that it works goes back to the deep unconscious fears that I was talking about a moment ago. We have this idea that regardless of our chosen values is kind of impressed upon us from a very early age by all kinds of sources in society. Number one, that there is a clear boundary between the two sort of socially allowable options of gender, and that that boundary is impermeable, right? And that to seek to cross it is to commit some sort of grave sin against society. As we begin to move close to those boundaries, others feel that it is their duty to impress upon us in no uncertain terms that those boundaries are sacred and are not to be crossed. We know from, as you said, from our study of scriptures, both ancient and somewhat less ancient, right, that those boundaries are not impermeable at all, that those boundaries, in fact, mean very little to the God that we claim to worship and that we claim we belong to.
The world's changing so fast. I think what we learn is that human sexuality is infinitely more complex than we ever knew or wanted to admit. And once you admit that it's very complex, then it sort of feels like all bets are off. Boundaries don't matter anymore. There are no more boundaries. And that anxiety, I think, in the culture is really easy to play on if you want to use it.
The church is a very small c, conservative kind of institution. We don't change quickly. We don't turn on a dime.
Would you describe your own journey in terms of claiming your identity as a spiritual one, and how so?
I would call it a spiritual journey for me. I say that because the questions for me were always theological questions. I was given this framework within which to understand this difference within myself, and the framework was sin. Now, I didn't need the church to tell me that it was wrong. I had kindergarten classmates, right, through whom I took on enough shame that I could have gone through my entire life without ever encountering the church and still would have had that understanding. But because I was given that understanding, I initially sought the aid of God. God, why am I like this? Please make me not be like this, or change me so that I don't feel this dissonance within myself. I spent about 30 years trying it that way. And at the end of about 30 years, I looked at my watch and I looked at heaven and said, okay, so look, it's been a while now, and not only have you not fixed this, but it's gotten worse. And I was sort of left to grapple with that. What does this say about God, that I would be this way and that God would not change this for me? Does it say that God doesn't exist? Does it say that the God I've been praying to is a delusion? Does it say that God does exist but is not compassionate in the way that my faith tradition has taught? Is God trying to teach me something? And if so, why haven't I figured out in 30 years what that thing is? Or is God just sort of taking glory in my suffering, right? Which, although it would appear to have some scriptural basis, sounds dangerously like torture to me. It took me another couple of years of wading through theological texts and Bible studies and talking to people on all different sides of the issue to arrive at the understanding that God had not fixed me because I was not broken, and that I was free. God had freed me to, in the words of the psalmist, I think, seek peace and pursue it, right? Not only through the texts and traditions of my faith community, the rituals and practices of that community. For example, I had sought exorcism for the demon of femininity that I imagined lived within me, but also to seek peace and pursue it through medical doctors, right? Upon whom God's hand rests as surely as upon any pastor who ever counseled me. Therapists, one of whom quite literally saved my life and offered me hope. And other people like me, and frankly, like many of the people who contributed to this resource, who walked this path before me, and who, once I became aware of them, showed me that there was a path to walk.
The resource comes at it from the notion that transgender people are actually God's gift to us. What do you think God is giving us in giving us transgender people?
We challenge the notion that humanity itself is as simple as we often are led to believe it is. It is a very human bias to imagine that others see the world in the way that we see it, experience the world in ways that are roughly analogous to the ways that we experience them. And when we're presented with those who don't, our tendency can be, frankly, to sort of shut them out or to keep them at arm's distance, right? Because we're not quite sure what to do with that. This is certainly not what Jesus did. It's not what communities of faith in that tradition did before the arrival of Jesus, at least those that were seeking to live most deeply into the call of God. Now, they occasionally have had to be reminded of that. But I think by helping churches to recognize just how far-reaching the golden rule is, just how much empathy we have yet to learn and to practice in order to live into the aspirations of God for us, I think we provide a much-needed gift and a much-needed resource to the church beyond the gifts that each one of us naturally brings into communion.
Bishop Gene Robinson and Baptist pastor Allison Robinson continue their discussion about transgender welcome. A bishop makes the case for affirmation with practical answers to questions of inclusion next time on This Way Out. The resource booklet can be downloaded from AmericanProgress.org. I'm Lucia Chappell.
Hi, this is Greg Louganis, and you're listening to This Way Out.
Out Sochi Olympics free skier silver medalist Gus Kenworthy talked about being humbled by better singers at a gay bar's karaoke evening in the Silver Lake suburb of Los Angeles during an appearance this week on the U.S. TBS cable channel's late-night show Conan with Conan O'Brien. He also spoke with the host about coming out.
You were the first action sports star to come out publicly.
Yeah.
And that took a lot of guts, and it was something that was weighing on you for a long time. Is that right?
That's right, yeah. I've always been gay. I knew I was gay, I think, when I was like 5 years old. I've known for a long, long time, but I grew up in a really small town, 2,000 people, a class of 48 kids. I turned pro as an athlete when I was 16, and it was just something that was just like hard for me to kind of come to terms with, and I didn't want to say anything that I thought was going to give me any sort of separation from the pack. I didn't want to differentiate myself or,
right,
I don't know, alienate myself in any way. So I had a hard time with that, and yeah.
But you were considered for a while at Sochi coming out maybe on live television at the Olympics.
Yeah.
What were you thinking? What were you contemplating?
Well, leading into the Russian Olympics, there was all this anti-LGBT legislature, and they had warned people about, like, if you're gay or if you any of the athletes are gay, like, try not to show it, kind of.
Because this is not
because
accepted.
Because it's very unsafe.
Yeah.
It's not accepted. And I was like, that's bullshit. I'm not going to. I mean, I wasn't even out, but I was like, that's ridiculous. And I had a boyfriend at the time and had
kind of talked about like landing the best run ever and like winning an Olympic gold medal and like kissing him at the bottom. And I was like, that'd be my way of telling everyone. But it didn't happen. I'm glad it didn't, actually, because I hadn't told my mom, my dad, my brothers. It would have like not only been a shock to the sport and to the Olympics, but like my family would have been like, what the hell? I was like, I'm gonna just take a little bit. And I right after the Olympics, I kind of started telling some of my friends and my family. And then, yeah, this last summer, kind of got my ducks in a row to come out with ESPN.
Mm-hmm. The relief must be massive.
It has been so massive. And I was nervous because I didn't know how the other skiers and how people were gonna react to it, just because no one in action sports has done this. And so I was really nervous, but everyone, for the most part, has been so great that it's been it just makes me feel really good. Everyone's been amazing.
Well,
that was out Olympics free skier silver medalist Gus Kenworthy this week on the U.S. TBS cable channel's late night show Conan with, as fate would have it,
Conan O'Brien.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. This week, Sarah Sweeney, Wenzel Jones, and Lucia Chappell contributed program material with thanks, as always, to Steve Pride. Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Yavanna Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our listener supporters, for making this program possible. You'll find more information about the show, the crew, a video teaser for our special From Outlaws to In-Laws compilation CD, and even more at thiswayout.org. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on WCBN Ann Arbor, Michigan, 3OCR Colac, Victoria, KCMJ Colorado Springs, Colorado, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. And we're all going to stay tuned.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio, found online at kpfa.org. I'm Sasha Lilly. Our modern era is an era of fear. Whether in times of war or peace, we've come to expect those in power to use fear to rally support for themselves, sometimes with diminishing effect. But political fear runs both ways. The fear that the people have of those in power is matched and intertwined with the fear that elites have of those they rule. The ways that fear has been conceived and deployed politically in the modern era is the subject of an enduring work by political scientist Corey Robin, Fear, The History of a Political Idea, published in 2004 by Oxford University Press, examines the intellectual trajectory of fear in its myriad forms. As an elite tool to unify a stratified society, as a means of social control, and as the shadowy, lurking fear of the downtrodden. Robin teaches at Brooklyn College and the CUNY Graduate Center. His latest book is The Reactionary Mind. I spoke to him extensively last year, and today we rebroadcast that conversation. I began by asking him how political fear differs from other kinds of fear.
Political fear has a very public character that differentiates it from individual fear. All of us have our own individual fears that really say very little about the state of public life. I have a fear of heights, for example. But there's no political source to that fear, and there's no political consequence to that fear. And I think all of us could go through a whole inventory of our own personal fears that neither, as I say, arise from the public realm, nor do they have any consequences for the public realm. Political fear is something whose origins lie in the political realm. So there's number of examples one could give. The fear that blacks had in Jim Crow America of their white overlords, those were not private personal fears. I mean, they certainly had personal consequences and they were experienced at the personal level, but they arose from the political realm and they had tremendous consequences for the political realm. It underwrote a whole system of entrenched racial hierarchy and white supremacy. And so that's what I think really distinguishes personal fear from political fear. And what I'm really interested in the book is political fear and how to think about that. And I have a set of arguments about that that we can get into in this interview.
And listeners may assume that when we're talking about political fear, we're simply thinking about that kind of instrumentalist use of fear by elites to control populations. But as you illustrate in your book, fear in the elite mind can take a number of different forms. And in a contemporary setting, one of the things that has flourished, and I guess in particular flourished after September 11th, was this notion amongst liberals that political fear, or a response to political fear rather, could be in many ways an answer to a sort of atomized society, something that could pull us all together. Can you explain that for us?
Yeah, it's actually a very old story. It goes back to the foundations of modern thought. But I think the simple argument for liberals goes something like this, and this is a certain type of liberal, I should say, but it goes like this, which is, we live in a world, the human condition is such that we live in a world where we all have permanent, intractable disagreements about what is right and wrong, what is good and right, good and bad, good and evil, just and unjust. And for the liberal, there's no way to actually resolve those differences. That's just what it means to be human, basically, or at least what it means to be modern. We can't go back to the medieval Catholic worldview or the ancient Greek Aristotelian view, in which you could say, well, this is what it means to be human, and therefore this is what it is to be good. That's the world we live in, says the liberal. And in such a world like that, we have to find, however, some source of commonality. And one source of commonality that we can find is the fact that fear is the worst of all possible experiences. We may not know what good is, but we certainly know what the bad is. And in fact, we may not know the summum bonum, the highest good, but we know what is the worst evil, the summum malum. And that worst evil is fear and the practices of cruelty that inspire it. So, for instance, genocide, right? You can say you believe in God, you don't believe in God. You can say you believe in democracy or you believe in a different system, but nobody could credibly argue that genocide is a good thing. This is the argument that a lot of liberals made, particularly in the 80s and the 90s. From that agreement about what is the worst thing that's, again, the worst bad, as it were, we can generate a whole society, a whole collective form of existence where we can live together and cooperate. So that's one big part of that argument. And the other is the one that you noted in your question, which is in addition to being divided in terms of our moral principles, we're also sociologically divided, right? There was a big book that was written in the late 90s that got a lot of attention called Bowling Alone by Robert Putnam. And it's an old story, but it's basically that we all live these very individualized, atomized existences, what David Riesman called the lonely crowd in the 50s, and that we have no way to come together. And what fear, and by fear in this case I mean the fear of an enemy, the fear of another, the fear of Al-Qaeda, the fear of bin Laden, that kind of thing. What that kind of fear can do is to create a sense of commonality and a sense of shared destiny in which we are willing to come together and make sacrifices. And what was so astonishing to me was, and given the argument of my book and the intellectual history that I had engaged in, I shouldn't have been surprised by this, but I really actually was surprised, was how many liberals in the immediate aftermath of 9/11, far from condemning the atrocities, I mean, they certainly did that, but there was a way in which they welcomed them as well. And this is people like George Packer in The New Yorker. Even people like Frank Rich early on, you know, said this is a way to really get us out of the kind of pedestrian existence we were living in the Clinton, you know, the go-go 90s. And so that was the second part of the argument. So it's a two-pronged argument. One is about moral disagreement, and from that we can generate agreement. And the other is, out of the lonely crowd, we can become a kind of robust army of collective will.
And perhaps it will become more apparent as this conversation continues and we talk about the history of modern political fear. But let me just simply ask you, what's so wrong about liberals thinking that an opposition to these horrors and having fear be the glue, what's so wrong with that as being a great unifier? What are the political consequences of that?
Well, I think, I mean, and I probably, I don't even know if I knew this at the time that I was writing the book, but it's become so apparent since then, is it actually doesn't work. And the reason why it doesn't work is as follows, and this is where the history of political thought does become very important. If you look at ancient and medieval accounts of fear, they situated the experience of fear, the psychological experience of fear, within a broader moral framework. I mean, Aristotle, I think, is the clearest statement about this. Aristotle says that a courageous man, I mean, he talks about this in a couple of different ways, but one of the ways he talks about it is to say that a courageous man is somebody who fears the right things in the right way and at the right time. And in other words, and those categories of rightness, the way we decide what is right, is based upon a discussion of what is the human good? What does it mean to be human? What's the proper way to be human? So a courageous person, and he had a particular idea of what that meant, right? A courageous man should not fear poverty, should not fear, or I can't remember, he should fear poverty, but shouldn't fear death on the battlefield, right? So there's a whole set of moral frameworks, and from those moral frameworks, you will learn to fear the right things in the right way at the right time. And I think in a way he's right about that. The problem with liberalism is it wants to sidestep that moral framework. It wants to say, look, there is a universal experience of fear. All of us are fearful, let's say, of violent death, right? We're all fearful of violent death. This is sort of one version of Thomas Hobbes' argument. So we're all scared of violent death. Well, the fact of the matter is we know that that's not true, right? In some situations, we're certainly scared of violent death. In others, we know that many people are willing to brave that for the sake of some other value that matters to them. So I think that's the basic problem, is that you're trying to smuggle a moral agreement in the absence of a moral agreement. In other words, liberalism isn't even true to its own deepest insights, and it's trying to build a foundation on something that you can't build. And as you know, as we saw in the aftermath of 9/11, that unity that we were supposed to have experienced in the face of Al-Qaeda evaporated extraordinarily quickly. I mean, I would say that, and you could see glimmers of it very early on, but you know, it really, I would say going into that 2004 election, that was the last gasp of that unity. You can't build a society upon fear. It just doesn't work.
You just mentioned the very important English thinker Thomas Hobbes, who really, in many ways, reshaped the notion of fear in the modern era. And while I guess you would see yourself on the opposite side of the divide from Hobbes, you also argue there's a lot to be learned from him. And he wrote his ideas around fear coming out of the English Revolution of the 1600s, which really upended society. And as an aside, the question of revolution and counter-revolution seems to be really important, actually, for the development of this notion of political fear. But perhaps you could start by explaining for us what Thomas Hobbes did with this notion of fear and what can be actually learned from him.
Okay. I mean, I think there's a couple of things. And where I would begin is something I've already suggested, which is that Thomas Hobbes is really one of the first great thinkers. There are a couple around him that are lesser known, except among academics. But he's really the first great thinker to wrestle with this problem of what we would call moral pluralism. That is to say, that we live in a fallen world where all of us has our definition of good and evil, right and wrong. And Hobbes said, you know, that basically there's no real way out of that, that is the world. There is no way of resolving that that disagreement, except, and here's the innovation of his argument, was to say that basically no matter how you define good and bad, you know, you think the pursuit of economic well-being is the highest good for you. I think the pursuit of literary excellence is the highest pursuit for me. You know, whatever that may be, however we define our own good, and he was very clear that we define our own good as we see it, you have to be alive in order to pursue that good, right? You cannot pursue economic well-being if you're dead. I can't pursue literary excellence if I'm dead. We have to be alive. Life is the condition, in other words, for the pursuit of the good, however we see we see it. And therefore, we have to have the fear of death should be the sort of the centerpiece of that existence. So that's the first that's the first part of the argument. The second, though, was that, you know, he wrote at the time of the English Revolution, which was an extraordinarily violent, cataclysmic event for Britain. I've seen figures to suggest that the casualty rates between both from the war itself and the diseases that ensued were something on the order of what the First World War was like, proportionately. And what Hobbes was so taken by, you might say, in a negative way, was the willingness of ordinary men and women to die, to both not just to kill, but to be killed, for the sake of how they defined the good. So, and this is something that a lot of interpreters get wrong when they look at Hobbes, because they say, well, Hobbes basically believes all of us are afraid of death, and it's a natural fear. Not so. He didn't think, he thought that was the problem, was that we were not sufficiently afraid of death. So what he did then, in kind of his masterwork, Leviathan, was to construct a whole vision of how you could actually go about teaching people to be afraid of death. And he has a whole elaborate vision, which, you know, we don't need to get into, but it involves, you know, what Lenin called the transmission belts of civil society, basically, which is that, you know, from the king to the universities, who would train preachers, who would then go out into the countryside and educate gentlemen and the ordinary, ordinary people, that they had to understand that they ought to be afraid of death, and that if if they were going to live, they had to submit to the to an absolute sovereign, the absolute power of the monarch, and that was the and this is the part that a lot of people don't get, that you know Hobbes is depicted as this terrible authoritarian, this totalitarian tyrant, but what his argument was that this is the condition of your own flourishing. Right. If you want to, again, pursue your own economic well-being and I pursue my literary excellence, there has to be peace. I have to be secure. And the only way you can get real security is by essentially consenting absolutely to the sovereign power of the monarch. And so there's what's so striking about Hobbes, to my mind, is not the authoritarianism of the argument. That's obvious. It's the way in which he envisions your own individual emancipation and flourishing to be premised upon this absolute form of submission to absolute authoritarian rule. And as I suggest toward the end of that discussion, you know, there's a way in which he's onto something there. I mean, I disagree with the vision, but if you look at some of the tyrants that have existed around the world, I looked in particular at some of the accounts of Pinochet's Chile in the 70s and 80s, you know, a lot of the testimony from people who cooperated and consented was that, you know, you got a better life, basically, in one way or another. And I think, you know, when we talk about authoritarian regimes, oftentimes we imagine these terror-stricken people who are completely terrorized and get nothing from their terror. But that, it seems to me, is very simplistic, that people who accede to their own fear usually get something for it. And that's what Hobbes understood, is that if you can make people see that they will get something by cooperating and acceding to their fear, you will have developed an extraordinarily powerful regime.
Right. So, in fact, it's not just a top-down theory, but a bottom-up as well.
Very much.
The program is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio, found online at kpfa.org. I'm Sasha Lilly, and my guest is Corey Robin. He's the author of Fear, and he teaches political science at Brooklyn College and the CUNY Graduate Center. So I'm afraid, for the purposes of time, I'm going to be compressing a fair amount of intellectual history in this, but you focus on two other figures beyond Hobbes who shaped our notion, or at least the modern notion, of political fear. One is Baron Montesquieu, who wrote what he did in the context of the tyranny of Louis XIV, and then Tocqueville, who responded to a changed climate in France following the French Revolution, which, of course, ousted and decapitated Louis XVI. So tell us how these two thinkers developed a notion of political fear, which has real ramifications down to our day in terms of how, as you said earlier, liberals see political fear.
Well, I think Montesquieu, there was really two innovations, and again, you can see them very clearly by comparing his account of despotic terror with Hobbes's account of what I call rational and moral fear. Montesquieu, basically, when describing the experience of fear, created what I think of as a kind of cartoonish, yet very influential, account of terror. This is the fear and trembling, where you're so paralyzed with fright by a bloodthirsty, ravenous, sadistic tyrant, and, you know, a real Caligula-type figure, that you are essentially divested of all reason. And you're reduced to the state of a kind of a trembling animal, a kind of Pavlovian dog, where you will do whatever you are told without even thinking. You become a pure instrument of another's will, basically. And that the way that that's created is not through this elaborate architecture that Hobbes had talked about, right, where you understand that the condition of your goodness, the pursuit of your good, is that you submit to the tyrant. All that kind of stuff is just completely out the window. There is no reason. There is no argument. There is no morality. It's just pure violence. It's the pure violence of a sadistic tyrant whose rule, Montesquieu compares to the kind of the physics you see when a pool cue hits a billiard ball. right? That's the kind of power he's talking about, the pure physics of violent power. So that was the first thing, was that he transformed, he stripped fear of all the elaborate architecture that Hobbes had provided for it, and reduced it to the experience of, you know, pure raw violence, which again was inconceivable to Hobbes for a couple of reasons. One, you know, he thought, well, witnessing these people in the Civil War, they weren't scared of violence whatsoever. They were willing to die. And so it was just sort of inconceivable to Hobbes. And also what was inconceivable to Hobbes, and I think this comes to the second innovation of Montesquieu, was that any one figure could ever wield that kind of monopoly of violence. For Hobbes, it was always, you know, you could say the army's going to force the people, but what's going to coerce the army? You know, so you need some kind of willing cooperation if you're going to even generate the kinds of violence or the instruments of violence that Montesquieu imagined. Well, Montesquieu, you know, there is no apparatus like that. For him, it's really this single-minded despot who has accomplices, but whose accomplices are as terrorized as the population are. And it's a very puzzling picture because, of course, well, how did that happen? You know, who is this despot? Is he some kind of strong man who beats them up himself? It's very unclear. So I'd say those are the innovations, is transforming the actual individual experience of fear by stripping it of all morality and emotion on the one hand, and then the political sociology of fear gets transformed, you know, whereas with Hobbes you have this elaborate set of institutions and moral instruction. Montesquieu it's just this despot with a monopoly over the means of violence, just wielding them indiscriminately. So that was the big innovation of Montesquieu's. Tocqueville, as you pointed out, comes after the French Revolution and the execution of Louis XVI. This is, you know, good. He's writing in the 1830s, so a good 200 years after Hobbes, almost 100 years after Montesquieu. And it's a very different world that he's describing, particularly when he comes to the United States. And for all the differences between Hobbes and Montesquieu, there was ultimately a notion that fear, whether it was understood as rational fear or terror, served the interests, or was created in a top-down way, even though Hobbes also understood there was a bottom-up dimension as well, but that the bottom-up for Hobbes had to be engineered from the top as well. Tocqueville doesn't understand that. He really believes in a democracy. Everything happens from the bottom up. There are no more elites. There are no more real institutions that govern the mass. Everything wells up from the bottom. So the mass is really governing both itself, and the mass is governing the top. And you can, you know, understand from his perspective, he was from a very big, prominent aristocratic family from Normandy. He had lost a lot of his relatives in the Reign of Terror. So, you know, to his mind, the notion that the masses could be governing and terrorizing the elite was not inconceivable. So that was the first thing. He turned the world upside down, or at least the way we think about the world. And then the second thing is that, you know, if Hobbes talks about rational fear and Montesquieu talks about despotic terror, what Tocqueville really talks about is mass anxiety. This is not a fear of violence. It's not a fear of punishment. It's much more the kind of anxiety that we were talking about earliness, of the lonely crowd. That is, people who live in isolated existences and feel without any kind of sense of security or sense of common belief system. And in that existence, they feel a tremendous amount of anxiety. And again, there's if you read any 1950s social thought, you see very similar accounts. And that mass anxiety produces the desire for a strong man, right? So mass anxiety generates this desire for a tyrant who will then restore everybody to a sense of commonality, common purpose. So whereas for Hobbes and Montesquieu, it's coercion and repression in part that create fear, Tocqueville flips that around and says, no, it's fear, now understood as anxiety, that creates coercion and repression. And that had tremendous impact on how 20th century thinkers understood things like totalitarianism and so on and so forth.
Yes, and the German Jewish thinker Hannah Arendt was very influenced by Tocqueville, as she wrote her very influential book, The Origins of Totalitarianism, about Nazism and ultimately Stalinism, making an argument about their basic affinity. Can you tell us what the thrust was of Arendt's argument in that book?
Well, the book is really actually divided into three parts, and I focus really on the most famous part, which is called totalitarianism. The first part is on anti-Semitism, the second part is imperialism, but the last part is totalitarianism. And there she makes an extraordinarily powerful and very vivid case that basically the modern world is about the creation and the experience of a profound sense of isolation. Even to the point of what she calls loneliness, which she distinguishes from isolation. It's that Tocquevillian account that everybody lives a very private existence, bowling alone, right? And we lack the confidence and the assuredness of traditional institutions, you know, religion, and local neighborhoods and things like that, and we're just thrown out into the world, into this abyss of anomie. Anomie is a big concept, you know, that develops in the 19th century and that she makes quite a bit of. And out of that experience, that terrible psychic experience of loneliness, we long for not just a strong man, a Hitler or a Stalin, but somebody whose strength and terror is tied to what she calls ideology. That is, an ideology, she says, is a completely fabricated and fictitious world, but it's consistent, and one in which we can have some confidence that our expectations will be fulfilled. It's a world that's not like the real world, where, of course, everything is inconsistent. I mean, just think of our everyday experience. You know, sometimes things work out, sometimes they don't. We have ambivalence, we have conflict, all of that. All of that gets wiped away in the world of ideology. And instead, and she thought Marxism and fascism were two, the profound ideological, or Marxism and racism, were the appeal of those ideas was not that they subjugated, class enemies or racial enemies or anything like that. It's not the content, it's the form of the argument. And it's an argument that has all the predictability and consistency of mathematics. Right? 2 + 2 is always 4. You can always count on it. Doesn't matter where you are, doesn't matter what time period you're in, it will always be true. And that's what ideology provides. And the problem is, of course, is that then you have to make the ideology true, right? If you say that the Jews are a pestilence, that are the enemy of the race, they need to become that. And if you say that the Jews are a dying race, they need to die. So he has a kind of predictive capacity that needs to be executed. And that, she says, is what, the concentration camps are really, and the gulag are about. They are laboratories in which ideological truth is established and executed. And the consequence of those laboratories is an awful lot like what Montesquieu described in his account of despotic terror. We become Pavlovian dogs. We are reduced to automatons. And that, for her, is the ultimate catastrophe and nightmare, is that human beings, whose singular capacity, she always argues, is our capacity to invent things new, to do things different, right, to change patterns, to establish new patterns. That's what makes us human, is our ability to break with the predictability of natural rhythms. Right, a dog gets up every day and eats and runs and sleeps. There's a predictability there. Humans can break with that. What totalitarianism does, in order to produce this consistent ideological universe, is it has to destroy that capacity for novelty, that human capacity for creating something new, and therefore it turns people into instruments and automatons that look like that kind of physics of power that I described earlier in Montesquieu.
And yet, interestingly, Hannah Arendt revised her assessment of political fear and the nature of fascism in her book about Adolf Eichmann, who helped oversee the execution of the Holocaust. In 1961, she traveled to Israel to report on the trial of Eichmann for The New Yorker, and the resulting book was Eichmann in Jerusalem, which, in fact, was very controversial. How did her ideas shift in that work more than a decade later?
She looked at Eichmann, and far from seeing the sort of the lonely crowd, right, the isolated individual, the flotsam and jetsam of mass society, what she saw in Eichmann instead was a very different kind of animal. And that is somebody who really just wanted to climb up the ladder of established society. So, of course, the premise of the book is that the premise of the origins of totalitarianism is that established society and institutions had been overthrown by the 19th century, and that what totalitarianism was to try to solve the kind of psychic wound that's created in the absence of traditional institutions. But in Eichmann, those traditional institutions are alive and well. I mean, and Arendt was an extraordinarily accomplished and acute social satirist, almost like a 19th century novelist, a British novelist, or a Viennese kind of satirist like Karl Kraus, who could see that kind of striving parvenu type who really just wanted to get ahead and be accepted in good society. And that's what she saw in Eichmann. So far from being part of the lonely crowd, he's willing to just work his way up the greasy ladder of success. The other thing also, and this is something she was really attacked for, this is the famous argument she makes about the absence of Jewish, not only the absence of Jewish resistance to the Nazis, but she says it's the real the fact is that the leadership of the Jewish councils, the Jewish leadership, were actually accomplices, essentially collaborators, who sent the Jews to their death. And she was attacked, and historically a lot of arguments have not really stood up. But I think what she was trying to get at there, the important point that she's trying to make, and this is, again, very different from her account of total terror, is in the origins of totalitarianism, is that terror requires collaborators. It requires people who are going to, implement its plans. And it was a return, I think, in ways to Hobbes's original argument. And the premise of that, of course, is that then you need institutions. These people, need to be paid. They need to be promoted. It's, there's a famous quote from Disraeli that I think I use in the book, where he's talking about the Orient. He says the East is a career. I think it's from Tancred. And, Hannah Arendt is saying that, genocide is a career, and it's a harrowing thought. But if you look at a lot of the reports, what we do now know about the Nazis and their collaborators, I mean, it was an extensive, world of collaboration. Likewise, in the Soviet Union and the Stasi in East Germany, these regimes exist not by pulverizing in civil society, which is how she described it in The Origin, but by insinuating themselves into civil society. And they gain collaborators not by crushing people into Pavlovian dogs, which is, again, the portrait one gets. I mean, she has, in The Origins, the closing chapters of The Origins of Totalitarianism, she basically says, even the people who are at the at the top ranks of a concentration camp, everybody knows that ultimately they themselves are going to be sacrificed to the purity of the ideology. So everybody, is ultimately a victim. And I think what she pulled back from that and realized, Eichmann is not sacrificing himself, and all the people who participate are not sacrificing themselves. They're actually trying to advance themselves. This is, and again, I see it as a kind of return to the original Hobbesian argument that fear is a form of self-advance. And I think that's what she came to in the Eichmann book. And, a lot of that got lost in all the noise about the accusations about the Jewish leadership. But if anything, I think that The Origins is a book that allows the Nazis to get much more off the hook, whereas in Eichmann, they're back on the hook. They're not just automatons. They're actually a real agent making choices.
And you're pointing to something which is a theme that runs throughout your book, Fear, the History of a Political Idea, which is that these institutions that are so beloved by liberals of civil society can actually be the mechanisms of repression and of the dissemination of fear. One example that you spend quite a sizable amount of time looking at in the book is the McCarthy era, where we have a notion of that period of time as being kind of the received wisdom is top-down, elites running amok, the rule of law failed, and it's sort of about the demonization of people, and that's about it. But you come at it in a quite a different way, both in terms of the impact of the repression on the public at large and the mechanisms through which that repression took place.
Yeah, I mean, and you've got the argument exactly right. Our whole constitutional system and our whole liberal democracy is premised upon a series of assumptions about what secures freedom, right? It's a state that is constrained fundamentally by, as you say, the rule of law, by an independent civil society that's very diverse and plural, and by a set of institutions within the state that are fragmented, right? So you have the separation of powers at the national level. You have a federated system with a division between national, state, and local. And, you know, we're all taught this in our civics books. And in the 90s in particular, when I was a graduate student, that argument achieved a kind of tremendous amount of traction in the post-communist world. The assumption was is that, you know, the problem with communism and the problem, you know, of totalitarianism is there is no rule of law, there is a unified state system, and there is no independent civil society. And when I looked at McCarthyism, which for me was, you know, one of the key moments in American history, I found that far from there being no rule of law, it was a regime at a time that was riddled with legal proceduralism, and you know there's any one of a number of examples that I think I cite in the book. You know, if you look at the way these laws were written, there was very careful attention to trying to identify who the real, you know, targets were. People who were called to testify before congressional committees, which again, you know, oftentimes depicted as you said, as this kind of Wild West. In fact, you know, there were very elaborate procedures that were very predictable, and that's a very important point to make, is that the people who make these claims about the rule of law, it's the predictability of the rule of law that makes people feel not coerced. Well, these laws were not arbitrary. They were actually quite, you know, careful and predictable, and that was their problem. It was who they were targeting. The role of federalism, you know, that this somehow or another, that the state, the division of power between the states and the national government is supposed to secure freedom. In my reading of McCarthyism, it actually exacerbated the repression, because you didn't just have, HUAC, you didn't just have a House Committee on Un-American Activities. You had something like anywhere from 30 to 40 little HUACs, they were called, including in California, where you are, a very powerful one, that did the same thing that the federal government was doing, it only it was more targeted in more local and specific contexts. So you had the reproduction, all the kind of the Smith Act, you know, which was used to such dramatic effect to prosecute the Communist Party, there were little Smith Acts, and so on and so on. So federalism, the separation of powers, actually, I argue, encouraged each competing branch of government to kind of up the ante of coerciveness in all sorts of ways. But I think the most important lesson that I took, but really the sort of kicker for me, or the take-home message about McCarthyism, is for all our focus on what the government did during the McCarthy years, right, everything from Joe McCarthy himself to the Smith Act to the trials, all these things, the real action, the real reason why McCarthyism so decimated America happened at the level of what we call civil society. It was not at the level of the state. Numbers. I think, you know, even if you're being your most generous or your most sort of latitudinous, you would say maybe close to 200 people ended up in jail for political reasons during the McCarthy era, which if you compare it to other tyrannical, you know, repressive regimes, it's peanuts, it's nothing. And so people look at that and they say, well, you know, it doesn't seem so bad. But if you look at the workforce, you find, and there's lots of estimates, but I've seen anywhere as high as 40% of the American workforce was subject to a political surveillance regime where they would be investigated for their beliefs and fired or demoted if they were found to be somehow or another disloyal. And disloyal was a category that was, you know, thrown around with great aplomb. It could mean anything from supporting civil rights, if you're in the South, because, of course, the only people who supported civil rights were communists, to supporting peace, to, you know, anything like that. And at that quotidian level of the workplace, you saw just a tremendous regime of an apparatus of coercion and repressive fear. And ultimately, if you look at other tyrannical regimes, which was the sort of next step in the implication of the argument, you'll find, you know, similar things. Obviously, in the Soviet Union, Nazi Germany, the state is much, much more active, but there is a tremendous role. I mean, if you look at things like East Germany in the 80s and in the 70s, you know, the Stasi really works through the whole sort of network of collaborators, you know, who are all private actors. And, you know, in the workplace, in families and things like that. So, you know, that civil society, far from being, as I said, far from being pulverized and crushed, the more independent in a way that it is and the more plural it is, the more opportunities there are for this sort of coercion to take its effect.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly, and my guest is Corey Robin, author of Fear, The History of a Political Idea. His forthcoming book is The Reactionary Mind. Well, in fact, your book does really take apart this notion, and as you say, it's been very, very fashionable over the last couple decades of civil society being the realm of democracy or being this bulwark for good. And one of the constituent parts, as you've alluded to, of civil society is private enterprise, the workplace. And you take a turn in the book, which might surprise some people, to argue that, in fact, one of the main arenas for political fear is, in fact, the workplace.
Yeah, and I mean, I think there's a couple of ways to think about that. I mean, one we've already discussed is that the workplace oftentimes is the adjutant of the state. And in the United States in particular, there's a very powerful reason for why that's the case. For better or for worse, we do have a constitution which puts constraints upon what the state can do, right? The state can't prescribe an official state religion, can't abridge freedom of speech, so on and so forth. However, and people oftentimes don't know this, and any union organizer will tell you, you find this with workers all the time, they don't know that the First Amendment doesn't apply to the workplace. You don't have freedom of speech at work. Any employer can penalize you for exercising your First Amendment rights with absolute impunity. And as we saw during the McCarthy era, that, you know, it's a kind of the state is almost has an incentive because of the legal constraints that are put upon it by the Constitution to outsource the coerciveness to the private sector to do the work that the state cannot do for one way, for one reason or another. So that's one dimension of the role of the workplace in political fear. It's an outsourced institution to do that which the state cannot for one reason or another do. But I think there's a second dimension which, you know, in recent years I've really begun to grapple with much, much more, which is that quite apart from whether or not the workplace is performing any service on behalf of the state, it is a regime of tremendous coercion in and of itself. It is, I mean, as I've already said, you know, many of The kinds of restrictions we have put on the state to create some kind of semblance of a liberal democracy do not exist in the workplace. And I have some fairly dramatic examples, but of people being denied the right to go to urinate, to go to the bathroom when they have to pee on the job. Purely legally, you can be told you can't pee. You can be told you have to go pee for a drug test. You can be told what to wear. You can be told what to say. You can be told what not to say. Employers have a power over their workers that if the state ever exercised that, we would blanch. And yet. You know, the workplace is this kind of unlicensed regime of power and domination that even today, exists. And in fact, I would argue has been getting more and more, has been getting worse. So I think, I point toward the end of the book that, for all the talk about, and when I said this at the time, this was perceived to be very controversial. I think today it's probably much less controversial. But, at the time, everybody was, terrified of bin Laden, al-Qaeda, and this, that, and the other. And, if you actually looked at the real day-to-day experience of people, who are they most afraid of? It's their supervisors at work. Because those are the people who have tremendous power. I mean, have real, real power over them. And as I said, when I said that, at the time, that was a fairly heterodox, controversial thing to say. We're still in the wake of 9/11. But I think now, as we're seeing with this kind of financial economic meltdown, you have two problems. I mean, one is people just don't have work at all. But in conditions where you have high unemployment, everybody is just thankful to have a job, and they're, all the more inclined to toe the line of the boss because, God forbid, you should get fired. What are you going to fall back on? So I think the role of the workplace, I mean, we have this mythology that, the American dream is, work hard, right? It's always work hard. Work is the key to emancipation. And if you actually look at both the reality and also, I think, our culture, I mean, there's certain sort of sub rosa markers in our culture that suggests we know that it's not. So, for instance, I look at the autobiography of Benjamin Franklin, who, the original Horatio Alger, hard worker and all the rest of it. Well, Benjamin Franklin became Benjamin Franklin because he fled Boston. And the reason he fled Boston, where he grew up, was because he was working for his older brother, who was a tyrant. And so he left that job, but he knew he'd be blacklisted, so he had to get out, and he took off. And not long after, he ends up in Philadelphia, and he becomes Ben Franklin. So my argument is Ben Franklin became Ben Franklin not through hard work, but through fleeing hard work. One of my favorite movies of all time, The Apartment with Jack Lemmon and Shirley MacLaine. What is that movie really about? It's about the kind of domination one experiences at the work, in work, where you're really turned into, you're really kind of pressed down on quite hard. And I think, we have films like 9 to 5, Working Girl. There's a real, if you read these films carefully and this literature, you see that, we know this somewhere. That these are regimes of tremendous domination and coercion. And yet we have a mythology, though, that tells us otherwise.
Political fear, then, the thread that sort of runs throughout, which we really haven't touched on directly, is that it is in opposition to something. There is this notion, an ambivalence at best, about the masses in the different thinkers that you've discussed and discuss in the book Fear, and at worst, a real horror of mass social mobilization in some way. And so the workplace may be one arena in which that is held in check. Which leads me to ask you, what is the relationship between, more broadly, revolution and counter-revolution, or social mobilization and the repression of social mobilization, that seems to be so central to the argument that you've been making?
Yeah, it's a good question. It's an excellent question. I think when we talk about political fear, we have a tendency, insofar as we do talk about it, to think about it as either self and other, or a nation and its enemies. Right? The Americans are afraid of the Russians. Americans are afraid of Al Qaeda. Muslims in the Middle East are afraid of the West. It's these very organized blocks that are afraid of each other. And it's a kind of a, Carl Schmitt called this the friend-enemy distinction, which has become a very fashionable term in political theory and political science. And the picture there is kind of two contending armies on a plane who are relatively equal, but are terrorized of each other. And Schmitt, in his political theory, thought that this was the kind of existential condition of our own being, was that, you know, we become who we are as a polity by virtue of our fear of an other. And that's the common way. And there's a certain truth to that. I mean, I don't deny it for one second. But I think, and what my book is really trying to get us to look at, is not to look at organized groups contending as equals on a plane, which is a very horizontal view of the world, but of a more vertical view of the world, in which people with power are contending constantly with people without power, or people with less power, people that they are ruling over. And that the theorists that I'm looking at, with the exception, you know, certainly up through Montesquieu, really understood that. They understood that fear was a tool of governance, a means of domination of people on top over the people on bottom. And I should also say, I mean, I don't talk about this as much, but, you know, people on bottom, you know, it's not just that the people on the bottom are scared of the people on top. The people on top are terrified of the people on the bottom. And for good reason, because, you know, you dominate people for so long, you're terrorized that, you know, one day they're going to rise up and slit your throat. And that's the story of American slavery and its aftermath in a nutshell. So the fears that I look at are really, you know, what sociologists used to call vertical fears, because they're premised upon hierarchies of power. And the sort of larger theory that comes out of that is that, and these are words that are so unfashionable today, but, you know, certainly in Berkeley as not long ago as I would say the 80s, and in other places maybe a little bit earlier, the forces of revolution and counter-revolution are really these fundamental forces that have shaped modern politics going back to Hobbes. And this sort of points in my new book that's coming out, The Reactionary Mind. Through this work on political fear, I was really led to uncover this world that, you know, we used to know about and talk about, but I think, you know, for a variety of reasons, one of which is the collapse of communism, the collapse of the left, the rise of the right, we've lost touch with that. It's ironic, though, because the one place where you will find an understanding of that is on the right. But on the left, it's been dissipated by all kinds of, you know, fancy theories and other forces. So and fear is really, I guess, like, through fear I came to see that world, because that's the world that these political theorists, beginning with Hobbes, really understood. You know, it is a world where, as John Stuart Mill called it, there is the party of movement, which is the left, the party of revolution, and the party of order, which is the right. I think those aren't the best ways of describing them, for reasons that I won't get into here, but that is the world that I'm trying to kind of, not to bring the world back into existence, it never went into a way, but that's the kind of language that I'm trying to bring back into our vocabulary, because I think it's the only, or it's at least a critical language to making sense of the world we still inhabit.
And that was a conversation I had last year with political scientist Corey Robin, author of Fear, The History of a Political Idea and the Reactionary Mind. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is co-produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us on the web at againstthegrain.org, where you can find on-demand and downloadable audio, submit comments, and find ways to reach us. You can also call us at 510-848-6767, extension 670, or look up Against the Grain Radio on Facebook.
Wisconsin Nature Notes from the Nature Conservancy. What is singing, blooming, creeping, and crawling in the Badger State?
February 2nd marks Groundhog Day, a truly unusual event given that the lowly groundhog is the only animal with an American holiday named after it. More surprising yet, groundhogs are rodents. There's no special day set aside for any other rodent. No Muskrat Day, Pygmy Shrew Day, or Bog Lemming Day. It's amusing when Punxsutawney Phil in western Pennsylvania and Jimmy the Groundhog in Sun Prairie, Wisconsin, miraculously emerge from their hibernation on February 2nd at the precise, instinctual time when the TV cameras begin to roll. But these photo ops must bewilder the poor groundhogs, which normally wouldn't come out of their hibernation in midwinter, even if the temperature hit 60 degrees. Groundhogs do, in fact, synchronize themselves to an internal clock, but not one on the wrist of a newscaster. Instead, the groundhog's clock is wound in harmonious rhythm with green vegetation, which is only available for a little over a third of the year. Groundhogs eat prodigious amounts of grasses and herbaceous greens, including garden and farm produce, which places them on the most wanted list throughout their range. But greens don't store well in moist underground chambers, so the ingenious groundhog evolved the notion that, rather than storing food underground for winter, it made more sense to store the food internally in rolls of fat. In nature, obesity doesn't often work well as a survival strategy because it compromises speed, agility, and defensive strength while making one particularly attractive to predators. But groundhogs have learned to fatten up very quickly right before they hibernate for the winter, a big belly being the greatest defense against starvation while hibernating in a safe den for 6 months. A groundhog chooses to spend half its life slowly starving while in hibernation. Groundhogs typically enter their den in early October, block the passage with soil, and then coil into a ball with their head between their forelegs and their tail wrapped around their head. Their heartbeat falls from 75 beats per minute to 4 per minute. And their temperature plummets from 90 degrees Fahrenheit to 38 degrees. For 6 months, groundhogs effectively become a cold-blooded animal and would appear lifeless if you could observe them in their dens. Groundhogs enter hibernation weighing on average about 10 pounds and awaken thin and weak, having lost nearly 40% of their weight. In Wisconsin, the winter will almost certainly last well into March or April, so no matter what newscasters say about seeing the groundhog's shadow, it's way too early for groundhogs and spring to awaken. Be patient. Learn how you can take part in conservation in Wisconsin. Go to the Nature Conservancy's website at nature.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Nature Notes is the work of the Nature Conservancy in Wisconsin and Mind's Eye Audio in Madison.